the Ursa's claws.
Welcome to episode 13 of the Age of Darkness podcast. As usual, I'm JP, and I'm joined by my co-host
Mark,
and we are here to entertain you and hopefully drop some truth bombs.
Talk about the 13th Legion.
Why would we do that?
It's episode 13. Come on.
Oh goddamn, we are talking about the 13th Legion, and aren't we?
We are.
Oh, isn't that appropriate?
Yep.
Okay, so I didn't think about that, but that is actually really appropriate. So in this episode, we're going to talk about the 13th Legion later, because we are doing a redux about Unremembered Empire. Now, in the last 6-7 months since we started this podcast, we've received a lot of comments about our first inaugural episode where we talked about Unremembered Empire, and now we're going to deal with all that. We're going to deal with all the comments, and we're going to apologize about all the shitty things we said.
Actually, he's not going to apologize.
Why would we apologize? We were right!
Exactly.
But so, yeah, in book club, we're going to talk about Unremembered Empire again. And before book club, because now my introductory segment is all completely mixed up. We're going to be doing part two of our discussion about the Conquest campaign system. And before that, because we're going backwards, I guess we'll do the introduction.
I'll splice
it in its proper order.
Okay.
So we're gonna talk about new stuff, then we're going to talk about Conquest, then we're going to talk about Unremembered Empire. Okay, as usual, like us on Facebook, subscribe to us on iTunes, and leave us a review. No one's leaving reviews. We want more reviews. It helps with the with getting some visibility for the show. So give us a review on iTunes. Send us an email at ageofdarknesspodcast@gmail.com. Join the Heresy 30K forum because it's awesome and full of awesome people. Check us out on SoundCloud. And also join our Front of the War and Oz 30K. Now, we just did a battle cast, which involves a battle between the Dark Angels and the Iron Warriors. That's also going to be pushing forward in the battles, in the initial battles for the Siege of Arklask Septimus, which is our role of the Global Heresy. So check us out on Oz 30K. All this stuff's going to be in the show notes. I don't know why we spent so much time on it.
Some people don't read the show notes.
Everybody should read this. Well, who's not reading the show notes?
I don't read notes.
Why aren't you reading the show notes? There's some
I
important
don't read the
stuff
show
in
notes
there.
To anybody's.
So a couple important things that are podcast related. First of all, I've been trying the last little time to get a bead on what the local scene is, the 30K scene, or if there is even a 30K scene. I guess it started when the Combat Face podcast asked me to talk about the Canadian 30K scene, and I had trouble coming up with a good answer.
Yep.
And I think the best I could do is embryonic. So anyways, I'm hoping that this podcast will be a way to actually start developing a local scene in our area of the world. I mean, that would be great. So to try to kick things off a little bit there, the Age of Darkness podcast will be putting on a small Victory's Vengeance campaign on November 7th, 2015, in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. And we don't know exactly what the specific location is going to be, because it's really going to depend on what kind of interest we have, like how many people are interested in coming down for this event. But it'll definitely be around the downtown of Montreal. It'll be on November 7th. It'll be Victory's Vengeance. So that means you're going to need about, 250 to 350 points of models. The rules are all in Book 3, Extermination. We are still discussing on what specific rules we're going to use, because Adepticon last year put out a sort of a modified Victory's Vengeance rule set. So we're still in the planning stages, but we did set the date. And we did set the location. So it's going to be November 7th in Montreal. We are going to be doing a small Victory's Vengeance campaign. And in many ways, this is going to be a dress rehearsal. If it winds up, we can, if we manage to pull it off, hopefully we can do a more elaborate one, maybe in the spring or something like that. This, in many ways, will be a test. But if anybody is in the general area or is willing to travel for a nice little informal one-day campaign, where everybody will play, like, I guess maybe 6 40-minute rounds or something like that. Again, we're still trying to figure out the details. But if anybody's interested, please let us know whenever you can if that's something that would interest you. So once again, Saturday, November 7th, 2015, will be one-day Victory's Vengeance campaign. You're going to come down, right, Mark?
Yes, sir.
Excellent. So already we got a little bit of a core. And we are going to be, we're discussing right now, what the specifics are going to be, but that'll all be up on Facebook soon, and you know, everywhere where we can put it when we've decided on the specifics. And also by the next episode in 2 weeks, we'll have an exact idea of what we're going to be doing. But I want to announce it as soon, at least the date. I wanted to announce at least the date as early as possible so that to try to get an idea of if there's interest in this kind of event.
And so we're locked in too.
Yeah, we're locked in. November 7th, we're going to do a Victory's Vengeance campaign in a one-day campaign in Montreal. So that is one important thing. The other thing that we really do need to keep reminding people is don't forget to send us your entry for our 30K on a budget competition. We already have a bunch of entries, so I'm super excited. We're getting some all the time. We're probably going to be devoting an entire show or maybe even two shows just discussing all the lists and seeing and you know before we decide on a winner. Mark, you want to run us through the contest rules?
Sure. Do we have them posted somewhere so I can read them, make it easier?
I don't remember. I have them written down. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I know what they are. Okay, you need to make the competition is you have you need to make a 2,000 point Legion army. It's got to be made of Forge World prices. You have up to 520 pounds to do it. You're allowed using drop pods from GW. That's it. No other plastic. Everything else has to be Forge World resin prices. And we will be judging the best list based on a combination of effectiveness on the tabletop and also just pure fluffiness. So, Mark, you get the first metric, and I'll get the second metric.
The tabletop effectiveness.
Yeah, because
I hate the fluff.
No, we'll work together to decide on a victor, and the winner will get Mark,
Legion champion and Master Signal set, which is on its way to me right now.
Perfect. And once again, since this is a sort of trying to show that it is possible to do a Forge World 30K army without necessarily breaking the bank, I think that the Legion Champion and Master Signal set is a great way to start the HQ part of your army. So that's what we're giving that one away. And yeah, keep sending us your entries. And the contest closes on October 3rd, Saturday, October 3rd at midnight Greenwich Mean Time. And the episode following that, we will start discussing and hopefully we'll have a winner by mid-October. But we need a little bit of time to go through the list and everything like that. And yeah. So send us your lists, preferably Age of Darkness podcast at gmail.com. But if you send us on Facebook or something like that, we'll find it. No big deal. Okay. Important shout out before we go any further and to make absolutely sure. Last time I was supposed to send a shout out. Completely forgot. So by ways of apology, we're putting this right at the beginning of our show and also to make sure we don't forget. So, big shout out to the Cardiff War Games Club. Guys, there's a wicked community down in Wales. Those are your people, aren't they? You're Welshmen.
My mom was from Wales. She immigrated to Canada from Wales.
Okay. So I knew you had some Welsh in you. Of course, yeah. I'm French, so I'm terrified about their longbow skills.
Of course
that's
you
bullshit.
Are.
Like my ancestors weren't noblemen. They wouldn't have they would have been like a feudal levy from like if any of my ancestors fought in the Battle of Agincourt or what's the other one? It was Agincourt and
I don't remember.
Crécy? You don't remember your Hundred Years War? Where the goddamn Welshmen like terrorized my ancestors?
Yeah, it was brutal.
And before the English get all high and mighty about how like, oh yeah, we won the Battle of Agincourt, it was Welsh longbows. That's what won that battle. And also some terrible tactics from French noblemen. But you know what? You killed a bunch of French noblemen. And as someone that's probably descended from peasants in the Poitou and Normandy and Bretagne.
Yeah. Well,
I thank you for that. So go Wales.
I read a book, actually, about this, the Hundred Years' War. And the author was describing it like economically a third world country taking over a first world country.
You mean the British? Sorry, not the British. That's hundreds of years later. The English taking over like a third of France.
Yeah.
Do you have any more details? That's a really interesting statement.
No, I can't. I don't have the book here with me, but I'll see if I can find it at some point.
No, but it's hilarious that the English, we tend to forget about this. It wasn't really a war between the English and French. Those concepts hadn't really developed yet in the 15th century. It was really the Norman French-speaking king saw himself as the rightful ruler of France. Like, we tend to forget that this wasn't a national struggle. Even though people later down the line, they turned the Hundred Years' War into a national struggle between England and France. It wasn't. It was a dynastic struggle because the English king was a French-speaking Norman who considered himself the rightful heir to the throne of France. That's all it was.
You're on my land. Get off my land.
Yeah, something like that. Of course, a lot of historians have argued that by the end of the Hundred Years' War, which lasted like 112 years, by the way, and like there was like a 30-year period of peace in between. It's completely stupid the way that these things are. the periodization is kind of bizarre. By the end of it, a lot of historians have argued that we have like a proto-national. This started to develop the development of national identities by the end of the Hundred Years' War. But for most of it, it's just a dynastic struggle. But not to get too much into it.
Once again, that'll be on our 100 Years War podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Go check out our 100 Years podcast. I'm a 19th century historian, too. But this is just to say that the Welsh are awesome people. And you should definitely check out the Cardiff War Games Club down in Cardiff in South Wales. Cardiff is the capital of Wales.
Are you reading like Wikipedia or something?
No, that was knowledge I already had. I already knew that Cardiff. You didn't know that Cardiff was the capital of Wales?
Yes, but the way you're saying it, like it's like you were reading it.
I'm just trying to say nice things about the Welsh because like we totally forgot to shout them out 2 weeks ago, and I felt bad about it.
The Welsh kick ass.
The Welsh do kick ass. They won important battles for them in the Hundred Years' War. That is all I know about the Welsh.
The English were scared of them, so they built lots of forts surrounding Wales.
Did they really?
Yeah.
Go Wales!
Yeah.
We try to be a community hub. I think all of the 30K podcasts try to be community hubs, and I think that's the most important role of podcasts. So if anybody wants us to shout... Oh, I did have another one, actually, that I completely forgot to mention. There is a tournament going on the 25th of September... So next, probably like a day. This, you know what? By the time the show comes out, it'll probably be like tomorrow. But if you're around the Lansing area in Michigan, which is actually a nice area, I was there. I presented a paper in East Lansing at Michigan State last year, and it's a beautiful area. There's an event going on the 25th, Michigan Grand Tournament, and there's going to be a Horse Heresy Narrative event Friday the 25th of September. Go to michigangt.com to check it out. And if you're in that area, man, the Michigan 30K has an amazing scene. Like I'm jealous of how fast things are developing in Michigan. Like all the Southern Ontario guys, the guys from like Toronto and London and Waterloo and shit, they all go to Michigan. They don't play in their own backyards.
I thought Michigan was Michael Moore would have me believe that Michigan is like a third world country.
Yeah, you see, this is the thing. Detroit is a blasted out wasteland. But as soon as you get out of Detroit, like I remember I traveled through Detroit when I was on my way to MSU. Michigan's doing fine. Detroit's doing badly. But the suburbs of Detroit are really nice. It's no one lives downtown anymore.
Yeah, I've only been there once and we made the wrong turn off the highway after we crossed the border right into, I guess, a really bad section of town. And like there were some people like pointing at us and some people like just drive, get out of here.
But no, Michigan's actually really nice once you get out of the downtown of Detroit. It's just like college towns like Ann Arbor and East Lansing. And they're really nice. And the suburbs of Detroit are nice, too. This is a state that's going well. It's just Detroit because the collapse of the auto industry. Man, right. We are just throwing in so much details for our shout-outs. Yep. So much extra useless information. So,
yep,
we are the Age of Darkness podcast, and we like to inform our listeners. So, yeah, check out on the 25th. There's an event happening in Lansing. Check out michigangt.com. You know what the good thing is, though? There's like almost no new stuff. So who cares if we spend extra time talking about awesome stuff elsewhere in the world that's not 30K related or only tangentially 30K related. So let's go into new stuff.
All right. New stuff.
All right, we are back to talk about some new stuff. What's new?
Blood Angel players rejoice. You got a whole bunch of shoulder pads, some wicked looking heads, and some torsos. Yay.
Is that it?
That's it.
Okay, well, let's talk for half an hour about this then.
KX 193 Tau.
I'm gonna stop you right there. I'm gonna stop you right there because I don't care. I'd rather we talk about the Hundred Years War for another 15-20 minutes.
Okay, all right. Well, there's a giant Tau suit out, people. JP will not suppress that.
You think I'm not gonna edit that out?
Well, I hope you don't.
I'm gonna suppress the news.
Anyway, so
stupid,
yeah, Blood Angel stuff.
Crap.
What do you think?
The Blood Angel stuff is gorgeous as usual. Everything they're coming out with is for the Legion specific stuff. The only Legion specific bit that I don't like is my own Legion's torsos. Why is there a star on the Iron Warrior's torsos? Is it the Eye of Terror? What is it? I don't know. But the Blood Angel stuff is gorgeous. It's gorgeous. The only thing I find funny and not cool. I think it's really cool. But they look like they have like. It almost looks like there's hair on their helmets.
Yeah,
like they have like coifs on their helmets.
Yeah, pretty much.
but it looks fantastic. It really really cool. What do you think?
Yeah, they're pretty sweet. One thing I do got to say, I actually was listening to the Eye of Horus podcast, and I agree with them with the unhelmeted heads not screaming. They just look kind of boring.
Well, no, they're supposed to look like serious, you know. Stoic. Yeah, they were supposed to look stoic.
Yeah.
You know?
He looks a little demented.
Do you think? Well, it's not as bad as the new the Legion Praetor. They changed the head on Legion Praetor.
Yeah.
You know the exclusive, the web exclusive model there? He just looks like an Ogryn or something.
I was ordering our Forge World and the guy's like, well, how about, would you like to get the exclusive model? I'm like, no, it looks crappy. And the guy's like, yeah, it's pretty shitty.
See, that's worth calling them right there.
Yeah,
I guess he had to try to push it.
Yeah, well, they didn't call me Cheeky Bastard this time either. So.
Oh, they called you a Cheeky Bastard last time?
Yeah, well, the last time I ordered, I was right on the nose for free shipping, so they called me a Cheeky Bastard.
Oh, Forge World.
Yep.
You should watch your mouth. Cheeky Bastard. Oh, no, they look fantastic. I love the Dark Angel stuff. The Blood Angel stuff. As much as I like all the Legion, all the Legion torsos are great. And it's showing you a little bit like what the plan is, eh? I mean, they put out the Dark Angel stuff, the White Scar stuff, and the Dark Angel stuff. And the reason they did that is because they were trying to get people to start their Legions. And the next book coming out, and I think this is official, that this is going to have rules for Dark Angels, Blood Angels, and White Scars. So the only two Legions that are going to be left are going to be the Space Wolves and Thousand Suns. But Prospero's still a little while off, though. But god damn it, that book's going to sell like gangbusters.
Probably, yeah.
Well, you got two of the most popular Legions. I mean, Thousand Suns and Space Wolves. People love that stuff. And you're also going to have Custodes and... Custodes. We said we were going to say Custodes, too.
Custodes.
Got to stay consistent.
Yeah, you're right. I agree.
So Custodes. We're going to have Custodes and Sisters of Silence. Man, that book's going to sell like gangbusters when it comes out. So Forge World, I know you're listening to this. Alan? Can I call you Alan? Give us our Prospero book. We've waited long enough. Are you going to buy Custodes? Didn't you start putting money away for the Custodes? Oh, no. You were practicing your Sigmarines.
Yeah, they're my gold practicing right now. I'm doing all kinds of different things.
So you're going to get a whole Custodes force when it comes out?
Maybe. I don't know. Just depends.
Didn't you say specifically that that's what the goal was?
Yeah, actually, I did say that, didn't I?
What did I say about consistency? You know what they say? Consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds.
The hobgoblin of small minds? Awesome.
Yeah, consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. My old Canadian economic history professor used to say consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. It's an important piece of news. Yeah, it's important philosophical treatise. Is that it for new stuff? That's it.
That's it. And
there's nothing else.
Yeah, giant Tau suit.
Stop mentioning the Tau suit. I'm editing that out. I will suppress this news.
No.
The Tau are like in 30K. The Tau are just like
tadpoles.
Yeah, they're not. Maybe they are tadpoles. Oh, no, they just, you know, they're like cavemen. Cave Tau.
Cave fish communist men.
I'm sure they haven't developed Marxism yet. It's going to take a while for them to build Marxism. Okay, stupid Tao. They shouldn't exist. God damn it. I hope one of the, like, I hope there's, like, an alternate history where, like, one of the legions goes to, like, virus bomb their planet, and then there's no Tao in 40K, and everything's better.
That would make me like Dan Abnett again for making John Grammaticus.
You're too hard on John Grammaticus. All right, so that was new stuff. We talked about other stuff more than what was new, because there's nothing for some reason. So hopefully in 2 weeks we could talk to you about the Legion Macedon, the Ordinatus. We could talk to you about what else is coming down the line.
Just the Macedon.
You're not going to see the Macedon for a while. Eh? That's like next year.
Oh, God. I hope it's before Christmas. Come on.
No, it's not going to be before Christmas. What do you care? You're not going to have more money in Christmas. You're going to have less money.
Well,
because you have to buy me a present.
That's right. I have to get you.
Perdurabo.
If the dollar gets better, sure. That's an expensive present.
So that's new stuff. We'll move into part two of our discussion about the Conquest campaign system.
Yeah, part two. And we'll don't right forget back. About the KX-39 battlesuit.
Stop it. So welcome back to part two of our discussion on the Conquest campaign system. Now, just to reiterate what we said last time, this system is just so beautifully simple and has so many opportunities for complexity. It's actually wonderful. And one of the things that we're trying to do right now is encourage people to use it, because I don't know of very many people that are using this system. Conquest is one of those books that outside of the auxilia list, like, we tend to forget about, and it's so much content. So right now we're just, as with last episode and the next one actually, we're really trying to encourage people to give the Conquest system a chance. It's just awesome.
Oh yeah, it's freaking amazing. I keep trying to get people to want to use it, but everyone's like, oh, it's too much reading, it's too complicated.
It's not too much reading. That's the thing. That's what I'm trying to get at. It's not complicated when someone breaks it down. And that's the goal of this series, of this three-part series about the system. We're trying to break it down. We're trying to explain to people that it's not too much reading and it's not too complicated.
So I agree.
In the last episode, we explain the basic system, like how the thing works, like at a very basic level. And we described pretty much like the simplest way to do it, which was like Warzone, Warzone X with strategic objectives 1, 2, and 3. Of course, that's not super fun. I mean, at a very basic level, that can work. That's how simple the system is. I mean, you can run it with, you can spend 10 minutes planning it out and then you can start running it. But where it really gets fun is because there's a ton of stuff that, a ton of options that you can bolt onto it, onto the basic motor, and to make it an incredibly fun narrative, strategic system. Like, there's a bunch of things you can add to it, and that's the goal of today's episode. We are going to be going through all the options that you have, all the options that you can throw into it to make it more to your liking and to make it more fun.
We're just going to sort of briefly go over the Warzone traits and then a little more detail on the strategic objectives, because those are the key things. Like, the Warzone traits are neat, just something fun that you could have happen to your battlefield. Hey, you want to fight on Hoth? Well, you could fight on Hoth.
Who the hell doesn't want to fight on Hoth?
Right? You could fight on Endor in an endless forest, right?
Why are all your examples from Star Wars? You know, that's hilarious, though. That's something that is such a sci-fi trope that, you know, all planets have only one type of climate. You know, you have the forest planet, and you have the snow planet, and you have the desert planet. You know, it's like no planets have, you know, a bunch of different things like, you know, a realistic planet would have.
Yeah, I know. Do you want to go fight in, you know, the Dune world? Then, you know, you got burning deserts, right?
Okay. It's called Arrakis. Is that correct?
Oh, fuck. I don't know.
I think it's called Arrakis. I never read Dune, but I did play Dune 2 on PC back in 1994, and it was awesome. Oh.
So the Warzone traits basically are going to give your battlefields a little more flavor, which is always good.
Of course. It is awesome. So, okay. So how these work is, we've mentioned before, you have war zones and you have strategic objectives. Now, the war zone encompasses it depends on how you structure the thing. Either you can give the entire war zone a strategic like a war zone trait, or you can give objectives war zone traits.
Yeah, for example, you could have a section of your planet where it's a rad waste because you came in and, you know, you bombed part of the population or a sector of the planet, where you could have your city done up where it could be treacherous ruins because it's been destroyed, or there's a section that's entirely forest, so you can use the endless forest. Basically, just it's really simple, just to sort of plug them in like that.
So you essentially you decide which one of the objectives, you know, what they have as a war zone trait. But you can also have ones that encompass everything.
Yeah,
you can entire war zone could be like a burning desert, if you want to play on Tatooine. Apparently, we're using Star Wars references. I'm going to switch it to Star Trek references soon. So yeah, you can either, you have two options. Either you put them to the entire war zone, or you can just give them to a single strategic objective.
Yeah.
So Mark, okay, we were discussing this earlier. Originally, we were going to go through all of these, but then you mentioned that our listeners could read.
Yes.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure they wouldn't mind reading it.
All right, so we're not going to go through all of them because, you know, we don't want a five-hour show. So we're just going to pick out a couple that are cool and discuss them real quick and hopefully give an idea of what you can do with them. But then we're going to go into the strategic objective traits, and we're going to go through all of them because they're pretty game-changing. I mean, the war zone traits are a little – don't have as much effect.
Yeah, it's more flavor and just a little bit more fun on the tabletop.
Okay, because last time we discussed Hive Cities and we discussed Broken RuneScape. Perhaps so. Okay, throw one at me that you think is cool.
Frozen Wastelands is awesome. In a game played in a war zone or strategic objective affected by this trait, at the beginning of each player's turn, before the movement phase, each unit of infantry of any type, beasts or monstrous creatures without the cybernetic cortex special rule must take a toughness test. If this test is failed, they get -1 to their initiative, weapon skill, ballista skill, and all movement, including run moves and charge moves, reduced by -1 until the beginning of your next turn. Gets hot weapons. Do not get hot. That is awesome.
That's cool.
Successful dangerous terrain tests for vehicles have to be re-rolled. And all close combat attacks gain the rending special rule, which is awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty... that's a lot of fun. So would you put that for an entire war zone or just a specific objective?
It just depends, I guess, on what your war zone's going to be. I mean, you could be fighting for the polar ice caps of a planet or something and just stick it to that. Or you could be fighting on a frozen moon. I don't know, you know?
So, yeah, you can either throw that one. You could say that the whole war zone, the whole campaign is being played on Hoth, or Hoth could just be one of the objectives.
Exactly. You could even use it for something in space if you wanted to, because it's almost like fighting in the void.
Is there one for void combat?
No, there is not, actually.
Because you could easily use the Zone Mortalis rules if you wanted to do one that was in the void.
Yeah, well, the Frozen Wastelands are kind of like the void, except it's a little more treacherous with the having to take initiative checks on things, but...
I think that even the Frozen Wasteland is almost better at representing void combat.
Yeah, everyone's getting a little slower.
Yeah, the gets hot like thing is awesome.
So what jumps out at you? It's a fun one.
And honestly, they're all pretty awesome. I think one of the funnest ones would be Rad Wastes.
Ooh, yeah.
And we mentioned it before. What I like about Rad Wastes is because you can throw in some extra fluff too. You could say that this sector of the greater battle was like the victim of rad bombing.
Yeah.
Like rad missiles and shit. So Rad Wastes is really cool. In a game played in a suitable war zone or strategic objective affected by this trait, for any units not equipped with hardened armor, void hardened armor, or an invulnerable save, the opposing player must roll a single d6 against the majority toughness of that unit at the end of its controlling player's turn. If the result is greater than the unit's majority toughness or a natural 6, then the unit takes d3 wounds with no armor saves allowed. Awesome. And once again, breachers are great.
Yep.
Vehicles or units embarked within a vehicle or building are unaffected by this rule. In addition, at the start of the game turn, both players must roll a d6. If the total score of the two dice is 7 or greater, then the player whose individual dice score was highest must place a large blast 5-inch marker anywhere on the table and scatter it. This large blast marker will always scatter the full distance, and all models under its final position suffer an attack using the following profile. Strength 4, AP 3, Heavy 1, Fleshbane, Radphage.
Yeah.
Honestly, this would be crazy fun. It reminds me of that of one of the East of Van 3 missions. You know, the one where things catch on fire. It's one of those that that will affect the game, but none of these are particularly game breaking. They just add extra flavor. I mean, this one could potentially do some damage, unlike the Frozen Wasteland one, for people that aren't running breachers. But why aren't you running breachers?
Yeah.
Are you looking for points efficiency? Use breachers.
Like the Frozen Waste one's more just going to sort of dictate the speed of the battle, I guess, because more things are going to get stuck and, you know, guys are going to get negative to their move. So,
yep. Another one like that is Grasping Mar.
Yeah,
which is great. Things get caught in the mud. All of these ones are, I think they add so much extra flavor. And that's why we discussed them a little bit in the last episode when we were talking about, it's like, okay, this is the essentials you need. It's, I don't see why you wouldn't use these. I think they add so much flavor to this system. So it's just an example of something you can just bolt onto the system to just make things more entertaining. And once again, you can do anything you want. It doesn't have to be these. If you're like planning on running a campaign, you can come up with some on your own. For example, we just mentioned the Blood in the Void expansion from Book 3. You could easily use those rules as a Warzone trait. So you have ton of options. Now, Warzone traits add extra flavor. None of them are particularly game-breaking. However, strategic objective traits are, take it one step further.
So strategic objective traits, you're going to apply these to your strategic objectives to basically add more flavor to it, but also, like it says, it's more of a strategic purpose. The reason why you're going to want to attack this area to get more control points than your opponent so that you're going to have a bonus and they're not. It's really going to up the tactical play of the game, where you're going to have to be picking and choosing where you're going to want to attack and why you're going to want to control this objective over other objectives.
Yep. If you start handing these out, I mean, these have an effect on the campaign in general. So when you start putting, and I don't think all strategic objectives should have a strategic objective trait. They should be a few of them have, and this is where it's the key battles are going to be fought, because these ones have an effect on the campaign in general.
So do you want to just jump right into some of them?
Yeah.
Okay, so the first one we're going to go through is Planetary Spaceport. How this one works is for the player, or I guess it'd be your side, right, that has the most control points at the strategic objective, you're allowed to deep strike any units that you have held in reserve. Basically, you're assuming that they've been airdropped or they're coming down from the spaceport in orbit or something along those lines. And in addition, you can reroll failed reserve flyers coming in from reserve, which is pretty damn awesome. And if you have the highest amount of control points here, a single flyer of any kind available to the army list that makes up the player's core detachment may be included in the army, paying the usual points cost, but without using up a force organization slot. So that's pretty cool.
In all of these cases, it's the side that has the most control points there that gets to use it.
Yeah, I guess we'll just, from now on, we're not going to bother saying that. It's just, that's what it is.
Okay. Yeah, that's how all the strategic objective traits work. Whoever has the most control points, like as we explained in the last episode, if you're confused at what a strategic a control point is, turn us off, listen to episode 12, and we'll explain it to you in the past.
Perfect.
Is it in any battle, or is it just there? Is it just at the spaceport?
Any game played at a strategic objective affected by this trait. So it's just that one.
No. In addition, as long as the controlling player's side has the highest total of control points at this objective, a single additional flyer of any kind available to the army list that makes up a player score. You can use this anywhere. The second
just
part, the first part where the deep striking part has to be at the spaceport, but if you control the spaceport,
you can take an extra flyer.
Yeah, exactly.
If you that's a reason to get it. So you can give yourself a potentially more fast attack or heavy wherever your flyers are if you like using flyers, right?
Yeah, that's actually huge.
I think this one's good. It's as good as some of the other ones.
I agree. It's not the best of these, but just having being able to take an extra flyer without it take, because when I play my Iron Wars, for example, I'm always running low on heavy supports, like heavy support slots. That's why I run Onslaught a lot of the time.
Yeah.
If I could take a Fire Raptor and it not a fork a slot, a heavy support slot, that's huge for my army. So this is actually really cool. Well, all of these are actually pretty cool. So I'll go into Armory Vaults. So I guess this represents like a Vrax kind of thing. And this would actually be very appropriate for the Warzone Arcalask Septimus. Perhaps something we'll discuss next in the next episode.
Yeah.
So anyways, this is like a Vrax kind of like an armory world or an armory area. In a game played at a strategic objective affected by this trait, all units belonging to the side which currently has the highest total of control points at the strategic objective may reroll a single fail to hit roll in each shooting phase. In addition, and this is the second part, as long as the controlling player side has the highest total of control points at this objective, the warlord deployed by the player in any game at any strategic objective may upgrade one weapon they carry to have Mastercraft special rule for no additional points cost.
That's pretty
now,
cool.
Now, remember that most stuff, most things in 30K do not have access to Mastercrafted.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool.
Like, a Praetor can Mastercraft one thing, Centurions can't Mastercraft anything. Of course, Mechanicum can Mastercraft anything they want for 5 points. But that's the Mechanicum. And they cheat. But that can actually be pretty huge. And I'm assuming this doesn't count in their, like, may Mastercraft one weapon. So you could have a Praetor with two Mastercrafted weapons.
Yeah, that'd be pretty awesome.
If you're, for example, I guess a Primarch could also Mastercraft something. And a lot of their weapons aren't Mastercrafted. Like, I don't think Forgebreaker's Mastercrafted.
I don't know off the top of my head, but it would be cool.
Yeah. So, okay, once again, we have two parts of this. You have some specific rules for when you play at that strategic objective, and you have more special rules that if you control it, will give you bonuses. Once again, not the most game-breaking, but cool.
Yeah.
You want to get into a Manufactorum Complex.
Okay, so how this one works is if you have the highest total at this one, every time a friendly vehicle is removed from play, you roll a d6. On a roll of a 6, you get to put that vehicle back into your ongoing reserves. What do you think about that?
It's actually pretty awesome.
It could be really cool. I mean, it might not happen, but
I wish there was a way to get a reroll on that one.
Yeah,
if you've learned from the last battle cast, I'm not great at rolling sixes for Lehman Russ's coming
in. Yeah, I'd be like, oh, damn, they blew up my Typhon. Shit, I rolled a 6. I get it back.
Oh my God, But that's the game. That's game right there. That's game right there.
Probably.
Like,
probably.
If you're playing a game and like turn 3 and you take out the Typhon and you just put so much into destroying it, and then that die roll might be game.
It could potentially be game.
Or the flare shielded Spartan. I guess there's nothing in it. Doesn't change much.
And
that's huge. Every time a friendly vehicle is removed from play.
And the second part of this is basically you're allowed to take an extra tank of any kind that you have in your army list, and it doesn't take up a force organization slot.
So similar to a planetary spaceport.
So you want 4 Spartans in your heavy? You got 4 Spartans in your
heavy. That's awesome, and you don't have to take Onslaught.
Yeah.
That would be so cool for like my own army to actually try to control that just because I have to use Onslaught and go second. For that extra heavy support. You can also do it with Hammer of Olympia, I suppose.
Yeah.
But a lot of legions can't do it. Like, Iron Warriors, I guess, have two paths to actually getting a fourth heavy support slot. Most legions don't and might actually have to take Onslaught. I think that's huge. And once again, you have to get control points onto this. And this is when the campaign gets really fun, because then you have to start actually like planning out. It's like, we need to control this Manufactorum Complex for so-and-so reason. And you just start throwing games at it and trying to get control points. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
Okay. But okay, the ones described give you bonuses. But they're okay. If I was the warlord and we were playing a campaign and we were a bunch of us and we had to, you know, start trying to get control points at something, which one do you think I would throw control points at?
Macro weapons battery?
That is correct. The side that has the highest total of control points at the strategic objective can, at the start of each mustering phase, roll a d6 for the macro weapons battery. If it scores a 5+, then the opposing side must reduce its reserves points pool by -1. This may not be used to reduce the opposition's reserve points to 0, as the macro weapons destroy drop pods and transport ships carrying troops and supplies. Mark, you want to explain how awesome that is?
Well, considering you only have a limited number of reserve points, the ability to knock them down potentially to 1 is amazing.
You're essentially destroying the enemy's strategic initiative because you need to spend a reserve point to initiate a battle. The only way you can get control points and the only way you can score on objectives is if you're the attacker. So you need to expend a reserve point to get a control point to try to win the campaign. If you can reduce the enemies every mustering phase by 1, that is immense, because you're removing his ability or her ability to actually score points. Like, this is huge. Frankly, if the macro weapons battery was on the table, I would throw everything at it.
Every turn you'd want to be hopefully getting the initiative to be the attacker, correct?
Yeah, well, it's because the only way you can score points is if you're the attacker. And this is the other subtlety of this system. When you think about it, it's like, okay, well, it make more sense if, you know, you have to assign armies to every war zone, but that just adds extra complexity. If you just make everything as the attacker scores points, it's so much more simple. But the defender gets an advantage because the defender gets gets to choose who's going to face it.
They're going to be like, oh, crap, well, the Iron Warriors are attacking, so we better throw some salamanders to defend, right?
Why salamanders?
They're pretty hardcore.
They're pretty hardcore. What would the Eye of Horus podcast say? A bunch of psychos?
I think that's when they referred to world eaters and...
Oh, no, they referred to everybody as a bunch of psychos.
Yeah, I guess everyone's a bunch of psychos.
It's not false. I mean, a space marine is just a psycho-indoctrinated warrior, post-human. But yeah, this is the one I would throw everything at to try to take if we were playing this campaign. Want to run us through Fortified Bastion Complex?
Okay, so once again, if you have the highest number of control points at this one, you may deploy up to D3+1 Wall of Martyrs defense lines or Wall of Martyrs Imperial bunkers. No additional cost. That's pretty damn cool.
Actually, that's really good too.
Yeah. Obviously, they have no upgrades or anything like that, but...
And that can be anywhere, right? That doesn't have to be at the complex? In a game played at a strategic objective affected by that. No, this one actually doesn't have any effect beyond the Bastion Complex. But I'll tell you right now, this is going to be useful later. And we're going to come back to this because when we start talking about lines of attack, this could be immense. And once again, perhaps appropriate for the Siege of Archelaus Septimus?
Well, I think so, yeah.
Perhaps something to discuss in 2 weeks. So yeah, if you're playing at this war zone... you can deploy D3+1 Wall of Martyrs.
I can see this one becoming incredibly difficult for your opponents if you start to amass more control points on it.
Why? Why more?
So
you only need one more. You only need one more to get the D3+1.
That's what I'm saying. As long as you have more than your opponent attacking, this one's going to be incredibly difficult for the attackers.
Oh, that is awesome. Once again, so it's just so thematic and just adds so much to this campaign.
How about this last juicy one?
Concealed Bunker Complex. A game played at a strategic objective affected by this trait should be played as a Zone Mortalis mission using the special Zone Mortalis board sections. You don't have to use their board sections. Thanks for the plug, Forge World. You know, you got to try to plug your models, but you can... I'm working on a Trench Warfare Zone Mortalis board right now. Even there's a guy on the Heresy 30K forum that just made an entire Zone Mortalis table... for I think 70 euros. So like 90 bucks, maybe 100 bucks. You don't have to use their board sections. This is a Forge World book and they're going to plug Forge World models. So should be played with Zone Mortalis missions using the special Zone Mortalis board sections to represent an incursion into the sealed halls of the bunker complex. In addition, the side that has the highest total of control points at this objective can, at the start of each mustering phase, roll a single d6 for the concealed bunker complex. If it scores a 5+, then that side increases its reserve points pool by +1. As the command staff reallocates supplies more efficiently to release troops from hidden reserve barracks.
Another one that's going to be fought over.
Yeah, you need, if you can get the extra one, the extra reserve point, well, that gives you more options to score points. Those are the strategic objective traits that are recommended. You can, of course, create your own, but all of them are cool. What's your favorite of these? What do you think? Okay, say that we were playing a campaign and you had all of these on the table. You had a planetary spaceport, armory vault, manufactorum, macro weapons battery, fortified bastion complex, concealed bunker complex. Which one are you sending, or are you trying to capture?
Primarily the macro weapons battery.
I agree. Of course, then, concealed bunker could be good too.
Yeah, those are the primary targets. I think the opposing warlords in this one, if one person's attacking the macro weapons battery, the other side's going to attack the bunker complex.
Okay. Yeah, that's just brilliant. Honestly, I don't know why you wouldn't play with these. They add so much more fun. And remember, the way that it works is you have to make attacks to actually score points on these. So that's when, in the mustering phase, when you're sitting down with your team and looking at the board and saying, it's like, okay, we need to throw everything we can at the macro weapons battery. So, okay, the first round, you're going to declare an attack on the macro weapons battery. You know, one of the defenders, you know, they're going to set up the defender. And then you just throw another one and just throw another one and hope to actually score points on it. Because the defender's not scoring points. If the defender wins, they don't score points.
Yeah, but remember, you can only attack it once, right?
Are you sure?
Yeah, you can only attack each strategic objective once.
No, man. You can declare as many attacks as you want. Okay, let's go through this again. The side, a challenge is issued as follows. The side with the initiative nominates a target strategic objective and one of its own players as an attacker. Note that it is only in games in which the designated as the attacker that players can score control points at a strategic objective. When defending, you gain no control points if victorious. The opposing side nominates one of its players to defend the chosen strategic objective. The side with the initiative must then reduce its reserve pool by one, while the opposing side pays no cost. Note that a side that has no remaining reserve points may not issue challenges, but may defend against those made by the opposing side. Each challenge represents a single game of Warhammer 40,000, which is played during the conflict phase. Note that while players may participate in as many games as they wish in any game turn, it is recommended that when possible, they participate in only one in order to make bookkeeping more manageable. That's it. That's how a challenge works.
I guess that's my brain adding things to this to get more in depth where you can limit the amount of attacks people can have. But no, I get you.
No. Your brain is making it less interesting.
Yeah,
because
yeah, it
then,
is.
Then if like if you have that macro weapons battery, you can throw all your attacks against the macro weapons battery.
You know where I think that's coming from? It's a holdover from Planetary Empires where you can only attack each place once.
No, it's not that at all. It's way more simple than that.
That's what I'm saying. That's where I'm getting it from.
No, but I love that though. I love the imagery of it. It's like, okay, say you're six players on one side and you all throw all six armies like one after another at the macro weapens. Try to bring it down, try to gain points on it to try to take control of it. Because if the enemy keeps reducing your points, like say that you don't have you play a three round or four round campaign and the enemy every turn reduces you by one, you can't score points.
Yeah.
You need reserve points to score points. You're not going to win the campaign. This is huge. You need to take it. So you need to throw stuff at it.
Yeah.
And the thing is, what's great, the other great thing is that if you fail, you don't give the opponent any points, right?
Yep.
You don't give
unless they have one of the warlord traits, correct?
There is one of the warlord traits. I believe it's logistician prime that on a 4+, the defender gets a control point too. But generally speaking, only the attacker gets points. So just throw everything at that goddamn macro weapons battery. Just throw everything at it. You need to take it or you're fucked. And that adds so much, like it adds an extra strategic level and a sense of urgency to campaign. It's like, what do we need to do? And then maybe if everything has strategic objective trait or something like that, perhaps, you know, if you throw everything at the macro weapons battery, well, you're guaranteeing that the opponent's going to maintain its control of the concealed bunker complex. So you need to think about these things. And again, this is such a simple thing you can bolt on to the basic motor of the conquest system, and it adds such strategic depth.
Oh, it's amazing.
Anything more to say about strategic objectives?
Nope.
We went on way too long about it. but you know what? I had a feeling this might be a four-parter, and I might be right. So let's skip ahead to more of the options that you can throw into this. We're not going to be talking about strategic raids or city fight. Again, There's always a chance it might be a four-parter, and that could be something we can discuss down the line.
They're really just different ways to play. So yeah. I think you could use those and say, you're fighting in this hive city. Well, all games have to be City Fight or something if you wanted to, right?
Yeah. There's such cool stuff like headquarters and the strategic raids. Like, they can give you different missions of what you need to do. These are some of the fluffiest, most narrative missions I've seen in 40K. Again, Quest, one of those books that people were disappointed when they saw it. It's like, why can't I have Prospero now? But Forge World put out, honestly, in just pure content, Conquest might be the best book Forge World's ever put out, ever. So we're going to go into more options and more stuff that you can bolt onto your Conquest campaign to make it yours, to make it more fun. So first of all, let's talk about System Conquest.
Here we have the System Conquest, where I guess this could apply to a large solar system, or you could even apply it to a planet, where your war zones are particular continents or areas of the world you're fighting for, correct?
Yeah, you could break this down. Okay, System Conquest essentially is a bunch of war zones. We described fighting in a single war zone. Essentially, System Conquest is just multiplies that into several war zones. This is something you're going to play within a couple months or a year or something like that. And, you know, we talked about you could bring it down to a very micro level. Say that I use the example of Stalingrad, you know, you could have like different strategic objectives within like one single city. Well, this widens it, and you can have different like phases. Like, imagine like Axis and Allies or Risk or something, and every country is a different war zone.
Yeah.
So this brings it to the macro level.
And basically, you're playing for campaign points in this, and you get those by being the victor in the war zone. And basically, it's like a normal game where you're going back and forth, picking your attacks and deciding who's the attacker, who's the defender, and all that. And it can either end when both sides have exhausted their points or when one side has decided to retreat voluntarily from the war zone. And what sort of benefit do you get from retreating?
Well, you get to carry over half your reserve points. Because we mentioned when you're out of reserve points, you can no longer make attacks and you can no longer score. If you concede a war zone, if things are going really badly, well, then you have the option of actually keeping half your reserve points into the other, into the next war zone. So this is in phases. Imagine, okay, let's look at the Harkarialis system where we're playing our Oz 30K Global Heresy campaign. Say that after the first phase of the Conquest campaign would be like Archelaus Septimus, which is the furthest out of the system. And that would be the first phase of the conquest, of the System Conquest. So you're going to play your whole standard round in that war zone. And then when that's done, then you carry it over into the next planet, which I believe is Casca Irilis.
Yeah.
So essentially, this is in phases. And again, adds extra levels of complexity to it. But this is something you're going to play over a long time.
Yeah, it might be in your fit to be like, okay, crap, we're getting our teeth kicked in at this place. So let's retreat, get points so we can strike back hard at the next sector, right?
Yeah. If you win a war zone, what do you get?
You get one campaign victory point.
You don't get any bonus reserve points?
Gains one victory point, and in addition, one campaign victory point if the war zone previously been the opposing side's territory. Oh, so basically you get double points if it's controlled by your opponent, 1 point if it's, contested?
If you win, you get to decide what the next campaign is, like what the next war zone is. Maybe we should break it down. Break it down to, like, how do you set this up? We're trying to convince people that this isn't complicated and we're just complicating things.
Well, we're getting into the more complex stuff. This is all the extras you can throw in. So say you have war zone A, B, and C, right? And you're fighting for war zone A, and either exhausted your points or one team's decided to retreat. Say team X wins, X gets to decide if they want to attack B or C next.
Absolutely. So say that you lost the first one, so your opponent's controlling A, but then you win in war zone B, and then you can attack war zone A again, and you get bonus points for actually retaking war zone A.
Yeah.
So that's how that works. And at the beginning of the campaign, you're just rolling a die there to see who gets to choose which one to fight over.
Or you could forge your own narrative and basically be like, hey, well, the traitors are launching an assault on this system, so they're automatically going to have the initiative.
No. What you said was you could forge your own narrative, where you should have said you should forge your own narrative. It says right there. point two, generate and name each war zone.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So, we're getting beyond war zone X and strategic objective 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Start naming some shit. And if you don't can't come up with any names, I came up with a bunch of them. Just play on our system in Harcarialis. I worked really hard for coming up with all those names. So once again, what this is just a way to link a bunch of these smaller campaigns together. Because we already mentioned that the basic conquest system, you can get that done in a day. You can play a conquest campaign in a day if you wanted. But this is a way to like link a bunch of these campaigns together into a wider campaign. And one of the things is that if you're doing really bad, it becomes impossible for you to win. Like if you're the if your side essentially like it becomes impossible for you to win. There's just no way for you to get enough campaign points, campaign victory points. Then you can have the option of either calling it or playing it and against the odds. Against the odds is a final war zone chosen by the side currently winning in the campaign. The side currently winning the campaign gains a number of bonus reserve points equal to the number of campaign points it has acquired so far. The side that emerges victorious from the final war zone is the overall victor of the campaign.
So your last desperate push.
You have one last chance, but the side that's already winning has a huge advantage. Because remember, you need to expend reserve points to score. So if you don't have any reserve points, you can't score. So I would do that every time. Why wouldn't you? You don't have a lot of chances, but you have like one final chance to maybe win that one. But again, you don't have, like, considering the odds against you, it's not great. So I'm hoping we didn't overly complicate system conquest. Essentially, system conquest is only a way to link together multiple war zones and essentially, like, you know, move the front line backwards and forwards. It's not terribly complicated, but it adds, once again, this is just an extra like level of complexity and narrative and fun that you can throw into your conquest campaign.
For sure.
And it is awesome. All right, the next option that you can throw into your campaign system is the hostile war zones.
Yeah, this is just a variation on how you sort of set up the campaigns, almost having a strict defender and an attacker almost, correct?
Yeah, the whole basic idea is that it sort of locks you in a little bit and sort of represents, not all of them represents like a strict attacker and a defender, but there's three basic ones. Maybe we'll go through them one at a time instead of like overly confusing people. So you have three different ways, and again, these are ways to set up the campaign, the different options. So first of all, you have Fortress Worlds. You want to run us through Fortress Worlds?
Yeah, so how this works is when determining this variant campaign for the setup and control points, the defender has half the attacker's number of reserve points, and basically you have to distribute these amongst strategic objectives. So basically it's showing that you already have a foothold on this planet or wherever you're fighting.
The defender starts with control points, like representing the fact that the defender already controls the defender is being attacked. However,
the defenders can only ever attack strategic objectives that the attack gained a control point on.
So it represents counterattacks.
Yeah.
The defender actually loses a lot of strategic initiative and starts with an advantage. But yeah, it's supposed to represent the defender being attacked. I think pretty cool.
But Desperate Sieges.
When using this variant campaign setup, the defender's side does not begin play with any reserve points, determine the attacker's total normally, but does gain a number of control points equal to 1/3, rounding down, of the attacker's side's total reserve points, which must be distributed as evenly as possible across strategic objectives present in the war zone. From the second campaign turn onward, during the consolidation phase, the defending side must check to see if their relief force arrives, roll a d6, adding +1 for each strategic objective where the attacking side has more control points than the defending side. On a 6 or higher, the relief force arrives and the defending side gains a number of reserve points equal to 1/3, rounding down the amount the attacking side began the campaign with.
That's pretty neat.
Note that if the attacking side expends all of its reserve points before the relief force arrives, the campaign will end.
Interesting. So you're basically you're crunching for time in this one. You want to get it done before they can get their reserves.
Exactly, and that's awesome. Remember, it goes from turn to turn. Like, you can keep making attacks. Like, how does it work? You can keep making tax until you're out, right?
Yeah.
I don't understand how this one works. Because couldn't you just expend all your points? Help me out here.
You theoretically could, I guess. I think this one's meant to be played with more points and more people.
Yeah. Oh, no, hold on. No, the two sides continue to make challenges until both sides choose to decline the opportunity to make challenges, whether due to lack of players or reserve points. So why wouldn't the attacker just keep attacking? Like, what's stopping you from doing that?
Oh, there's nothing stopping you from doing it. Because the defender has no reserve points.
I don't get this, then. Why wouldn't the attacker just spend all his points?
Well, that's the thing, is you might not have enough players to spend all your points.
Each player is supposed to play one game, right?
Yeah. So say you have four players, but you have 8 points. You can't spend them all in one turn. Does that make sense?
I don't know, man. I think you could easily go through it. But it says that you shouldn't play more than one game.
Yeah. Well, you have to sort of, you know, figure that out. Because you'd be like, oh, well, we just attacked you with everything. Game over. You don't get any reserves, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
I think it's meant to be played over a while. So
what you're saying is that it should be played with fun in mind as opposed to just winning?
Yeah.
Because this looks like really fun. It's just that technically there's not much stopping the attacker from just spending all his reserve points in the first turn. Except it's unlikely to happen, considering you're only supposed to play one game. Again, it's a really cool, and if you're playing with people that aren't, mouth-breathing assholes, you should be good.
Yep.
So, Ignorant Armies.
Using this option, the two sides bid against each other for which strategic objectives will begin play under their control. And it is most useful when used in conjunction with the strategic objective traits basically shown earlier in the book. And they highly recommend that you do a sealed bidding. So basically, you know, secretly writing down what you're bidding for. So how about you explain the bidding process, since I have no idea what's going on.
Okay. Once the number of types of strategic objectives present in the war zone has been decided, each side may then choose to bid for control of one or more strategic objectives by secretly recording a number of reserve points that they bid for control of the objective from the reserve points pool. Once both sides have had an opportunity to record the bids for all available strategic objectives, then the bids are revealed with the following results. If only one side has bid for a particular strategic objective, then the bidding side gains one control point at that strategic objective at the start of the campaign. If both sides have bid for the objective, then the side that made the highest bid gains one control point at the start of the strategic objective at the campaign start. If neither side has bid at the total and is deadlocked, neither side has control. All reserve points bid for strategic objectives are used up, whether or not the bid was successful. Some groups may therefore find it beneficial to increase the size of the reserve points pool when using this optional special rule. So you know how you have your total of reserve points?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, you could take those reserve, essentially gain early control of strategic objectives.
So you're all over the macro weapons battery, right?
Yeah, you just throw everything at that.
Bid all 8 at it. Come on, guys.
But then you have no reserve points.
That's fine. Just beat them every time they attack you.
Yeah. And I guess you can hope for that 5+ to try to bring them down.
Yep.
It doesn't seem like the smartest use of your reserve points.
No, definitely not.
But then, at the same time, if you don't bid and you want to keep all your reserve points to actually get that opportunity to get more campaign points, well, then you're essentially allowing the enemy to control, you know, the bunker complex and controlling the macro weapons battery, the spaceport. I mean, yeah, that's also risky. So you gotta play with a strategy. It's like, okay, how many can we afford to spend? And hope the enemy doesn't do, because either way you're wasting them.
Yeah,
they're gone. If you lose, then you lose. So go big or go home. What do you think of these of these war zones? Fortress Worlds, Desperate Seizures, Ignorant Armies.
They're interesting, I guess. Once again, you'd want to have your narrative centered around using these ones, particularly, I think.
Yeah.
But they're cool. They're just another little extra complexity. Neato.
You mentioned before we were doing this that you wouldn't use these.
I don't think I would, to be honest, unless it was very specific to what we wanted to, how we wanted to play a campaign.
Why? Yeah. Why? It looks fun.
I think it could be fun. I don't think this would be something you'd want to throw in your first campaign.
Oh, no. No, of course not. It's just that I don't think it's overly complicated. But once again, everything we're discussing today is just extra levels of complexity.
Yeah, like the next part.
I think this is extra levels of complexity. And I think it's really cool. If you're playing a very narrative campaign, I see this as being really cool. Okay, so do we go to the next one? Hopefully we explain this properly. Hostile war zones are a little bit more complex, and hope we didn't confuse anybody. Okay, the next optional rule that you can throw into your campaign is lines of attack. This one's a little more complex and hard to explain on the radio, because it essentially it involves a lot of maps.
Yeah. So if you like maps, you're gonna like this. I do highly recommend, if you got the book, look at their little diagrams and give it a good read through, because it is a little bit more complex, but it is actually kind of neat at the same time, because how it's working is basically your sides are picking points that you control, and you have like, you could use Axis and Allies again as an example, where you have, you know, a border of this province connecting to this province, but that's the only way you can attack or defend is going into that one. So you're going to have instances in this campaign where you could potentially only be fighting one opponent because you're pressing on that attack, unless there's another way for them to get to your sector.
Essentially, each player will occupy. Remember where we were saying that one of this the simple parts of the Conquest campaign system, one of the things that makes it really simple is that you don't really have to pay attention to where players are, in that, you know, the attacker declares an attack and the defender, you know, you choose someone to defend. And then you play your game. In this particular case, however, each player is occupying a strategic objective. Everybody has their zone that they're assigned to. And they can only move between zones in, like, each zone is connected to another zone.
So you're only ever attacking a certain zone, or it might be crucial to attack this large zone in the middle of the map that has access to all kinds of the spots where one of the defenders is.
Or it has a macro weapons battery.
For example, yeah. Like, this is an interesting way to throw down the campaign, where you can have a lot of interesting narrative to go along with this. Too, like, the Iron Warriors are coming in hard at the Imperial Fist defenses on, you know, section whichever. And they're trying to cut them off from the rest of the loyalists, so they can't get any reinforcements. It's kind of neat that way.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're willing to, like, write up a map or even use Planetary Empire's tiles,
yeah,
that'd be perfect. It's another way to actually do it. It's again, this is hard to describe on an audio format, but essentially all the zones are linked, and you can only attack zones that are adjacent to your zone. And each player is controlling one of these strategic objectives. Do we need to add more to this?
No, I just once again recommend people reading this one very thoroughly, even though it's only a page, but definitely read it.
Yeah, it's really hard to describe. But at the end of the day, all this does is it adds a map to the campaign that might not be necessary in a regular one, but you really need to start, like, seeing how, like, what this does is it links strategic objectives. It links them together, and essentially you can only go in certain directions, and players actually occupy a space board, which is something that's not in the regular system. I really recommend it, but yeah, it's something it's something a little more visual that's worth actually, like, reading it in depth. So let's move on from that one, and hopefully we're not confusing people.
Okay.
So let's move on to priority targets.
This is basically what this is. You're giving certain strategic objectives a higher value points that you can gain from it. So you could have, like JP wants, he has his macro cannon, where that one could actually be worth 2 points instead of 1 point for your side.
Which is probably appropriate for the macro cannon.
Yeah, for example. Or you could make the macro cannon less, so it's less likely that people go for it. So that's really all this is basically making certain strategic objectives more valuable, so you can get more points from them.
And also it'll affect what we said before, right? If you got the macro cannon, then you want to throw everything at the macro cannon. Well, if you got a fucking 4-point objective, then you're going to throw everything at the 4-point objective.
Or you might not.
Yeah. So no, that's actually a pretty simple one. That just affects which each one is worth.
Definitely, yeah, like this Hive City is worth more points than the Hive City.
Makes sense. So that's pretty simple. Actually, priority targets is not complex.
So how about Blood and Steel?
Blood and Steel is actually a really good addition. In this particular variant, each reserve point is worth a certain number of points in game. And they run at around 250. So essentially you're expending reserve points not only to declare challenges, but also to actually form your armies. So you can declare, for example, if each reserve point is worth 250 points, then you might declare 4 reserve points against the macro cannon to play a 1,000 point game.
Yeah.
That's not a lot of reserve points. I think you really need to up the amount of reserve points if you're using this.
I think this one would work better with a very, very small number of players or even a one-on-one campaign.
Not necessarily. I mean, if you up the amount of reserve points and you're saying it's like 250 points a reserve point, and it's like, okay, every player has a limited number, right? So you essentially have a limited number of total resources.
Yeah.
So if you, okay, again, we're going to use the example of the macro cannon battery. You say that you're going to spend 10 reserve points trying to take the macro cannon battery. Well, then the defender has to decide, it's like, is it worth throwing that many reserve points or should I conserve some for myself?
Yeah.
Sometimes you might just not even, you know, not even bother. Because remember, once you're out of reserve points, the campaign ends. So that's actually a really good addition.
Yeah, could add for some very interesting play.
It's just, you really need to up the amount of reserve points if you're going to go as low as 250 points. For a regular campaign, if you're like four or five people, we're talking about like 8 reserve points or something. So you're going to have to up it. But if you want to work with it, like play around with it, I mean, I think it's a great addition.
So what do we got left here? We've got the character Warzone assigned characters.
Yep.
Hidden objectives and character progression.
Yeah, we got to talk about characters. I told you this wouldn't be we couldn't get this done in one episode. There's too many options.
Cool. So yeah, this is some good stuff.
Ah, it's great. All these things, I'm hoping we're not complicating this system. Like the whole goal, well, of course, what we're talking about today is how to complicate the system.
Yeah. Also people should be reading, like have the copy and reading the rules too. Like we're just giving them, you know.
Yeah, we're just talking about how it works. I don't think we're meant to be solely responsible for people's understanding. Essentially, yeah. We're just trying to show that it's really fun and you should do it. It's really fun and you should do it. Is what
definitely.
I'm I think we did a good job, except for lines of attack. I think we failed at that one. It's hard to explain without it in front of you.
Yeah, so definitely give that one a good read and look at the diagram.
Exactly. But outside of that, and I guess the next episode, I thought that this was going to run long too. The next episode, we're going to be talking about characters, character advancement, and everything like that. Pretty much your RPGing up your 30K. And we'll also be describing like how we would build our own campaign system. And hell, maybe we could put out our own supplement and shit. You know, people could try to run it.
Yeah, for sure. That'd be awesome.
Oh, dude, we could just push Arcalas Septimus even more. I worked hard on that fluff.
Oh, totally. It's really good.
But that'll do for Conquest for today. We'll go back to it if it's too confusing there. Maybe we need to fix something. But that'll do for today. I guess all that's left is book club. And what are we doing for book club?
We are doing... What's it called?
Are you serious?
Yeah, I'm having a total, like, can't remember.
Isn't that a book about Ultramarines?
Yeah, it is a book about Ultramarines. Unremembered Empire. Yeah, there we go.
Didn't we already do that one?
We did.
I remember doing that one before. Are we coming back to it?
We're going to address all of our listeners' issues with the book.
No, the issues with our treatment of the book.
Yeah. That's a better way to put it.
Okay, we'll be coming back with an hour of apologies. No, I'm just joking. We were right. Yeah. We'll be back.
Yeah.
Who are you, Gulliman demanded of anyone and no one. His voice sounded small, enclosed by gunsmoke, cinched by pain. More bolt rounds came his way in answer, flaring out of the fissiling smoke that clogged the air. Gulliman threw himself flat. Bolts kissed the ruined desk and stuck the high windows behind him, creating cobweb patterns of cracks in the strengthening steel. Part of the window drapes collapsed. A picture fell off the wall and his frame shattered. A bookcase toppled over, spilling its contents in an avalanche of paper and leather bindings. How many had he finished? 5? And one other with a hand severed. Was it 5? How many of them would it take to finish him? He glanced around. The man he had cut off the desk was sprawled behind him on his back, still twitching. Blood had already stopped jetting from the stumps in his thigh, but the carpet around him was dark and soaking. He was reaching up weakly, aiming his bolt gun at Gulliman. Gulliman rolled and impaled the assassin to the floor with his power sword. The man went into juddering spasms and died. Gulliman wrenched the bolt gun out of his dead grip. Like the one Praetor had lent him in the night Dantioch manifested, it was like a pistol to him. It only fitted his ungauntleted hand. That hand was dripping with blood. He heard the remaining assassins exchanging guttural, coded words as they fanned around the devastated desk through the smoke to finish him. He didn't understand what they were saying. It wasn't ultramarine battle cant. It didn't matter that he didn't understand. Practical. Read everything. React. Their exchange told him plenty. It placed them, sound and relative angle. He knew without having to see that two were coming around the desk to his left and one to the right. He went to the left. He came around the desk firing. One kill. Solid. A headshot. A red fog. A second. Two through the chest. Something ran into him from behind. His mouth opened wide, a silent howl as he felt the sharp, cold bite of a Gladius blade punching through his backplate armor, running in under his ribs. It stayed there. It was wedged. Gollum had wheeled and smashed his gauntleted left fist into the face of the swordsman. The Ultraman was somersaulted backward by the force of the blow. He hit the window's face first, upside down. Despite the cobweb cracks, the glass did not break. The man dropped in a heap on the floor beneath him. Gulliman turned to track the remaining killers. The damned Gladius was still stuck through him. At least two shells struck his left shoulder armor behind his ear and detonated. He felt this through his head and snapped off to the right with a shockwave. He felt heat and ferocious pain. He tasted blood and visceline. His ears ringing, his vision gone. He fell. He couldn't get up. He was half propped against the desk or an overturned chair. He couldn't see. He fired blind. It was pointless. He fired again. He felt a blade against his throat. "Death to the false emperor," said the voice Gulliman had thought belonged to Aeon Ithiel. "Let me die knowing what you are," Gulliman whispered. A laugh. "Your killer." "What else? What else are you?" "I am Alpharius," said Thiel. Then the hateful rumors from Istvan. The treacherous masquerade and false colors were true. The Alpha Legion would employ any means. The deception through which the execution had been accomplished, the impeccable covert approach, it made sense. Gulliman had never had any martial respect for the elusive, cowardly tactics of the youngest Legion, but this had been superlative. "One thing you should learn from this moment, servant of the Alpha Legion," Gulliman said.
"When you have to shoot, shoot, don't talk."
All right, welcome back to Book Club. Today is the first of our episodes going back into an old review that we did and to sort of discuss some of the comments that we've gotten over the months, over the last months, and also just seeing if we have a new appraisal for the book. Talk about things we might have gotten wrong, things we got right. So I will just start. We're doing essentially Unremembered Empire Redux.
Yeah.
And this might not be the only time. Once again, there's a limited number of these books, and hopefully this show will go on forever, right? That's the plan.
I imagine it going on forever. Yeah.
So eventually we're gonna have to go back and tread the same waters again, but the goal is to do so in a different way, and in this particular case we're gonna go back into Unremembered Empire, and we'll once again discuss things that, you know, some comments that we've gotten over the last couple of months. But before we do that, perhaps we just, you know, do a quick summary once again of Unremembered Empire. Quicker than the last time, I would think.
Probably.
So essentially, Unremembered Empire, let's pick back up after Vulcan lives. Now, in our last episode, we discussed how Vulcan managed to escape the clutches of Conrad Kurz and essentially beamed himself into the warp, which is never a good idea.
Probably not.
But it worked for Scotty. Scotty was hit himself in a transporter for like 100 years. So Vulcan, only 2.5. And once again, the bridge between Vulcan lives and Unremembered Empire is about 2.5 years, is the Thramis Crusade. So Vulcan disappears at the end of there. Narek, the Wordbearer's character, who's looking for the Fulgurite Spear, spends 2.5 years like trying to track it down. He eventually finds his way to McCrag. Jandra Grammaticus, I don't know what he's been doing for 2.5 years. Do you know?
Yeah, because it's so awesome.
What was he doing?
Did it take
him
two
and a, I guess it took him 2.5 years to find Vulcan. Because when Vulcan shows back up on McCrag, then John Grammaticus goes to McCrag to find him. And then Narek, who's been tracking John Grammaticus, I figure, shows up there too.
Yeah.
So that's the bridge between... Because as I said last time, Vulcan Lives and Unremembered Empire need to be seen as a whole, as one story. And so you're doing that bridge. And once again, like we said the first time, Unremembered Empire, the whole goal of this is to bring together a bunch of storylines. So... once the Ultramarines discover the Pharaoh structure, they illuminate McCrag, they create a beacon at McCrag, and people start showing up. Vulcan's the first, Vulcan's not the first. The Lion's the first, and then Vulcan comes later, and then eventually Sanguinius shows up. Essentially, everybody's converging on McCrag, where Bob Gulliman, the war architect and space bureaucrat, is creating his new empire. His successor empire to the Imperium, which is Imperium Secundus. So that's the basic of... that's where we're at now with Unremembered Empire. I think it's further synopsis. Kurz shows up, causes a bunch of problems. Vulcan dies a million more times. John Grammaticus used the Fulgurite Spear to kill Vulcan permanently, or semi-permanently, I suppose. Narek dies, right?
Nope. They're interrogating him.
Okay, Narek is captured. I forgot about that. When we first did our review, I totally ignored Narek because I didn't remember him being an important character. But now after reading Vulcan Lives just now, or rereading it, I realize that he's actually a pretty cool character.
Yeah.
So at the end of it, Sanguinius eventually shows up. Gulliman, who's been wrestling with the fact that he doesn't want to be Horus for the whole book, is just, you know, I don't want to be in charge, which I don't believe, but anyways.
He wants to be in charge.
Of course he wants to be in charge. He just doesn't want to take the heat. He doesn't want people to accuse him of being Horus. He's a coward. So he just gets his brother to do it himself. Because he knows that Sanguinius now is going to take all the heat for what he's doing.
Yep.
So just stick his brother in the position and everything's good. And that's where we're left at the end of Unremembered Empire. Essentially, it's sort of like a season finale kind of book where all these different threads are sort of brought together in anticipation for the next phase of the Horus Heresy. That's a fair synopsis of Unremembered Empire, because I don't think we need to go any further detail. This is the second time that our listeners should have read it. If you didn't read it the first time we did it, like, I guess you're just not going to read it.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, perfect. So what's the goal today?
We're going to address what people have said and possibly change our minds on
it. Exactly. Address what people have been saying about us on the internet.
Oh, fuck the internet.
It's awful. No, actually, everything's been a great tone. I had the challenge of going through all the different areas of our media empire to try to find all these comments that people have made. So I had to go through our Facebook comments and messages. I had to go through the emails we've gotten over the last little while. I've had to go onto Heresy 30K forum, where there's been a lot of lively discussion about this stuff. And I realized that I'm not going to find it all. So I'll read out a couple comments, and there's one in particular that we received not that long ago that I think really, really summarizes most of the comments that we've gotten.
Okay.
And so we'll read out a couple of general impressions of our review from listeners. Then we'll go into this one message that this, it's a great summary of all the issues, and then we'll go through it. I've made 5 points where discussion has been generated, and then we'll go through it, and we'll talk a bit about what other people's opinions are and whether or not we believe that we were right or we were wrong. And maybe then we can talk about if essentially our opinions have changed, or if our opinions of anything specific have been changed, or if we continue to, I don't want to say dislike. I don't hate this book. It's just, it's not. But anyways, we'll come back to it. So first off, some of the early comments that we got when we just posted this episode, for example, Chopper, our friend Chopper on the Heresy 30K forum, he quote, "It's also good to know I am not alone in my opinion of Unremembered Empire. I really did not like the book. Abdon is on the league of ADB McNeil or Rate when it comes to 30K Marines." I generally agree. Oh, first of all, thanks for agreeing with us. But I think this is one of the key things. It's just when Abnett's writing Marines, he's not at its best. If you compare his work with writing Space Marines, and you compare that to Gaunt's Ghost or something like that, you can see where he's more comfortable.
Yeah, for sure.
What do you think?
Honestly, yeah, I find that he doesn't write Marines very well. Like you said, like I like his other books, like Gaunt's Ghosts and the Eisenhorn
stuff. Ravener and Eisenhorn books.
Yeah, I find those they're more enjoyable. But when he's writing Marines, I don't find them as enjoyable.
Well, it depends. He's written some. Like, remember we discussed No No Fear recently? No No Fear is amazing. I love that book. So yeah, it's not always it's not always bad. I think saying
maybe
that
hit or miss
with Marines. With Marines, yeah, he might be a little more hit or miss than he is with humans, and you know, humans like Inquisitors and stuff like that, which I think are all fantastic.
Yeah,
and he is one of the most talented authors that the Blackrock Library has ever produced, and one of the first, maybe even the first, like really talented author that they recruited. He's really is good, but I find that when he's writing Marines, he doesn't seem to really want to be doing it, and he adds a lot of extra characters that aren't Marines.
Like John Grammaticus?
Yeah, like Grammaticus and Ole Pearson and Gulliman's mom is another example. All the Remembrancers that he introduced in Horse Rising. All the cultist characters in No No Fear. Shoot me another book that he did for this series.
Legion.
Dude, Legion, not a single one of the Viewpoint characters is a Legionary. All the Viewpoint characters are humans, which is honestly maybe why that's the best book maybe the best book he's ever written, as far as I'm concerned. Or at least in this series, that's his best. So I would agree with Chopper. I usually agree with Chopper. That his he's not at his best when he's writing Heresy Marines. That said, he's still amazingly talented. And once again, Legion, Horse Rising, No No Fear, amazing books. This one's Unremembered Empire is also a good book. It's just it's not my favorite. But we'll get back into that. So that's actually a really good. That's a good comment. Part of the problem is Abnett maybe not being as comfortable with Marines. So let's let's throw another one out here. Again, these are some of the early comments when we I'd like to address on air when we first started the podcast on the Heresy 30K forum. Minister of Pork says, overall, I enjoy the book, but like you guys, I was left wanting. In my mind, it wasn't so much that Abnett didn't cover Gulliman's struggle with becoming the new emperor enough, but that he interlaced far too much comic book style Primarch action with it. I know I'm in the minority, but I struggle so hard with the Night Haunter. If he's as insane as he's portrayed in the books, how did he make it this far? His near invincibility in this book is what really turned me off. Although I'm not a Salamanders fan, Vulcan certainly gets treated like a punk for how easy it appears to be to kill him. Another solid point. Well, no, it's not that it's easy to kill him. It's just because he keeps coming. He never dies, but he seems to get knocked out. It does actually. Pardon?
I agree with him. It does seem like he's very easy to kill in the end, where they're just like shooting his head off, not like constantly. Just like, okay, this is a little stupid.
Yeah, it's not like in Vulcan Lives. When Vulcan Lives, it seems like Kurz has to come up with ingenious ways of ending his life, like the furnace and blasting him out into space and. It's just in at this point in Unremembered Empire, it just winds up being like, bang, you're dead. He's back.
Yeah,
bang, you're dead.
He
respawns Pearson? Like in a crappy video game. He just keeps respawning and he just keeps blowing his head off and he keeps respawning and just turn the game off.
Yeah, like what is he shooting him with like shuriken pistols in the head and he's killing him and Kurz can't cut his face off? Like,
yeah,
you know, like.
Okay, I would agree. What about the idea of all the Primarch stuff being like comic book action? Because this is something I found really compelling in what Mr. Pork says. That's a really good point. It does kind of feel like all you need to do is put the Primarchs into tights, and they might as well just be superheroes destroying Metropolis.
Yeah, well, they kind of are though. I mean, they are super powerful, but maybe he just went a little too much. Like, I don't know, because I mean, Angron catching a foot of a Reaver Titan, like, or a Warhound Titan—that's pretty cool, right?
That was awesome. That's one of the best moments in any of the books.
Maybe just some of the things they do, like the whole Gulliman Matrix time shit at the beginning, is pretty retarded. But
I don't know. But once again, we can come back to the author. Remember, don't forget, Dan Abnett was a comic book author.
Yeah.
I don't think he did anything particularly like superhero E. I remember he was the writer for Resurrection Man, which was one of my favorite comics when I was collecting comics back in like the 90s. I really liked that the more offbeat stuff like Hitman, and I was a huge fan of things like Preacher, Transmetropolitan. And one of the things I really liked was Resurrection Man. You ever hear of Resurrection Man?
No, I don't like comics.
It was canceled pretty early. It wasn't a very long one. It's what will wind up happening is that he's a character that never dies. He keeps coming back every time he's killed, but he keeps coming back with different superpowers.
Okay.
And I remember this one great issue, like with Hitman, which was written by I think it was Garth Ennis. And Hitman keeps killing Resurrection Man. He keeps coming back with like a new superpower. Most of them are worthless, so he just keeps shooting them until they get something useful. But that was a good one. It's a little more offbeat, so I don't think Abnett really did much straight up superhero stuff. But he was a comic book author, and yes, he still is. I mean, they did that McCragg's Honor graphic novel recently, did they not?
Yeah, that one.
The battle between the Infidious Imperator, is it? Yeah, and Infernus and Parade or something like that. Anyways, the battle between the naval battle between Cor Farron and Bob Gulliman.
Yeah.
So there might be a little bit of the superhero-ishness in this book. I don't remember not liking it, though. Actually, some of the things that I liked the most about this book was all the crazy Primarch fighting.
It was good. Yeah, I do like the crazy Primarch fighting. It's just some parts of it I didn't like, but...
I think that's a solid point about the superheroes. I wanted to address that one. That's good. Another quick comment from the forums. Tin Bane says, our old friend Tin Bane, Remember Empire was a spectacle. Night Haunter is extremely variable. The line is generally referred to as a badass by a heap of other Primarchs. It was fun, but kind of dumb, just like Vulcan lives. I mean, he keeps getting revived. Chuck him in a star. Would that do it, you think?
I don't know.
What happened when he was in the furnace and Vulcan lives? I mean, they incinerated him. I mean, did the ashes start coming back together? Is it like Dr. Manhattan in Watchmen, you know, like... first, it's like a central nervous system starts appearing, then eventually, like a skeleton appears as well, and like gradually, like he puts himself back together.
I don't know. They never really explain it. I mean, they guess they kind of do in the end of Unremembered Empire when they're shooting his head off and his head's just like growing back in an instant.
Yeah.
So maybe he just like they put him in the engine and he like incinerates and then he just poof, he's back.
Maybe. So I guess if you shoot him in a star, I mean, would he get out of danger? Does his resurrection powers like automatically bring him out of danger? Like when you die in Super Mario, I mean, you don't appear where you died. You appeared right before you died.
No, because then in the end of the book, when he's getting killed over and over again by Pearson, he would have been somewhere else, right?
So maybe shooting him into a star would work. I'm surprised Kurz didn't think of it. Seems obvious, really.
Yeah, maybe he was just wanted to have some fun.
Oh, he does have fun in these two books. It's a good time. I think okay. Those were just a couple of quick comments that I wanted to make. We have received quite a bit of these comments. However, I wanna underline there's one message we did get on our blog post on our blog page that really underlines most of the comments that we've been getting. And perhaps I could go through it and once again I've broken it down and then we can discuss each in turn because I think this really hits all the points of everything that we've been. Of all the comments that we've gotten. So this was from Rob on our blog page. And he says, quote, I found your review of Unremembered Empire interesting. I personally think it is the weakest of Dan Abnett's Horus Heresy novels, but that still placed it comfortably in the middle of the rankings for me. Personally, and not just to be argumentative, I found the whole of Kurz's involvement to be the weakest, dullest element of the novel. Because the book was back-to-back with Vulcan Lives, I felt that we had enough of Kurz, and frankly, the character is far less interesting for me than he could be. I always imagined him as being so incredibly broken that he should be unstable and contradictory, like Gollum in Lord of the Rings, but awesome. But I think he's a bit too obvious. I felt the story could have worked equally well without Kurz. Conversely, I thought the Alpha Legion versus Gulliman scene was the iconic scene of the book. I found it suspenseful and dramatic. I was disappointed that the title did not really play out and then Sanguinius played a very minor role, but I felt that your review was perhaps a little too tainted by the lack of things you wanted to happen that didn't happen and put a cynical slant on it, maybe. I get the desire to see a more nuanced character from Gulliman, perhaps ambition, but the line already fills that role. It was seen at the end of Fallen Angels and in Savage Weapons and in this novel. Gulliman isn't flawless, he's arguably the opposite of Sanguinius. Gulliman's method is so practical and functional that, and I know we don't know what happens to get Sanguinius to Terra, Terra would have been lost if everyone had stuck to Imperium Secundus. We've also seen a different side to Gulliman in the first Heretic. I also think the criticism of the mini Astronomican teleporter was a little unjustified. It was criticized as being a weird plot device to have an escape from Kurz, but the main point of the device is that it was to, the beacon to bring Sanguinius. That it was used as a teleporter was, in my view, a smaller plot point. It could have been done without a Xenos angle, but I didn't particularly have a complaint about it. I agree that this book suffers by being a necessary strand gatherer, but I overall enjoyed it. It's just not my top five. Unquote. So that's from Rob once again. So I find that this particular message kind of hits all the bases. And as I mentioned earlier, I was having trouble finding all the comments, especially on forum posts and emails and everything like that. And I find that this really hits the nail on most of the things that were discussed. It's a good synthesis of what people have been saying about our review. So I thought that I broke it down into 5 points and that, again, hit all the bases. And perhaps we can discuss each in turn and see if we remain committed to our point of view.
Okay.
Shall we? Point number one. A lot of people said that Kurz was the weakest point of the book, not the best. We loved Conrad Kurz in this book. A lot of people said that it was a little too much, and he was way too powerful, like being able to take on, like, he took on three different Primarchs in this book.
Yeah.
And it was like, people thought that it was too much, and that it got to the point that I know that the writers really enjoy writing Conrad Kurz because he keeps showing up. Everybody loves him. He's a really fun character, but people thought it was a little too much. What do you think?
I don't necessarily think it was too much. I think you needed a real threat there. Otherwise, they would have actually had to put some, you know, real content into it.
What do you mean?
Like, actually have Sanguinius in it for more than, you know, what, two chapters? Not even two chapters?
I think it was one chapter. I think I counted it last time we did the review. It was like 20 pages. He's there for like 20-some pages.
Yeah, I think it's I guess they needed to fill out the book with something, and they needed someone who was a threat. And because of, well, where Kurz was in the rest of the storyline, it made perfect sense for him to be there.
Well, of course, he should be there. He should be there because he was on the Invincible Reason. So it makes perfect sense to throw him in there as the antagonist of the book.
Yeah. You know, him fighting three Primarchs is cool. I mean, well, Vulcan, we know, is like mentally destroyed for some reason. And fighting the Lion and Gulliman was pretty cool. I don't really have any problems with that at all.
It was definitely a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. But having read Vulcan Lives, which is almost as much about Conrad Kurz as about Vulcan, and then right after going into Unremembered Empire, and remember, this is the thing. You could argue, I've said before that Unremembered Empire, this is the same story between Vulcan Lives and Unremembered Empire. However, it's also the same story between Prince of Crows and Unremembered Empire. And it's the same story between Fear to Tread and Unremembered Empire. Unremembered Empire is sort of, its role as a place to connect all storylines makes it that you do need to see all of these books as part of the same story. And it would maybe have benefited from there being a few books between Vulcan Lives and Unremembered Empire.
I think it was necessary
to put them back to back.
You think they could have put out some of those special release ones in between to sort of fill it out? Because wasn't this around the time that Talon and Ironclad came out?
Not Ironclad. No. This was way before Talon and Ironclad. It was maybe the first Talon book was a little bit after this.
Okay, yeah, that's
this is a few books ago. I mean, Unremembered Empire came out not last Christmas, or the Christmas before is when I bought it.
Okay, yeah.
And it was already out for a bit after that, but the trade paperback came out, I think, in maybe November 2013 is what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
So, I mean, as much as there's often so much time between these books already, I mean, I keep mentioning Fallen Angels. It's like, I want to know the conclusion of this freaking story, and I'll never know. Like, what's happening on Caliban? This has been, like, Fallen Angels, like, 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And just as an example, like, often there's, like, big pauses in between books that are clearly directly linked in. So, and they don't do back-to-backs too often. There's the opening trilogy. Which is like back to back to back. But outside of that, they don't do a lot of this in this series, which gives everybody kind of a break before going right into it. But they went Vulcan Lives and straight into Unremembered Empire, even though chronologically they're very far apart. They're about 2.5 years apart because we know the Thrandus Crusade was in the middle. I do understand if you did what I did not do originally and read Vulcan Lives and then read Unremembered Empire right after. I get that you might be getting sick of Kurz's antics because we get it after the first book. Okay, he's crazy. He's crafty. He's a fun little character. Everybody loves Conrad Kurz, but after, you know, almost 1,000 pages of it, I get you might be getting sick of it. I, however, still find it's the funnest part of the book, by far. I love all of the stuff with Kurz, and I think you are correct that you did absolutely need an antagonist in that. And I don't think Narek works as a big enough bad when you have so many Primarchs running around.
Yeah.
You really think Narek was going to be, like, the main villain? And he's not even a villain. He wants to kill Lorgar.
Yeah.
So if you remove Conrad Kurz, who's the antagonist? If you remove Conrad Kurz, the main conflict in the book would have to be the doubt between the Lion and Gulliman.
Yeah.
And then Sanguinius, which may have made for a stronger book, but you wouldn't have a lot of action because they're very likely, they're unlikely to try to kill each other. I mean, they're not going to fight like tooth and nail like they would with Conrad.
I don't know. I mean, the Lion and Leman Russ were going at it pretty hard.
No, that's because Leman Russ is kind of an ass and he keeps killing his brothers.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, man, Leman Russ had dust ups with a lot of those guys. Like when Angron beat the shit out of him. No, I have nothing against Russ. It's not like a character I hate. It's just that you needed Kurz in this. He might have been in there too long. And a lot of people thought that him being able to fight both the Lion and Gulliman so effectively and then beat the shit out of Vulcan, it was a little much. Like, they amped his power level quite a bit since, you know, he got mortally wounded in Thramnus.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think it's a fair criticism that... But this comes down to taste, I think. I really love Conrad Kurz. And if you find his antics tedious, you're not going to like this part of the book. I don't think this is a criticism against what we said. It's just one of those things, like, it's one of those things that... Some people are gonna prefer different things.
For sure.
Let's move on to... Okay, this is the thing we got the most flack for. By far, this is what people did not like about what we said. Was the firefight between the headhunters... or the fight between the headhunters and Gulliman.
Okay.
We are perhaps among the few people in the world, in the community, that think this scene is stupid. People
what?
Love the scene. I'm telling you, 90% or 95% of all the people that have mentioned either a review or more generally talked about Unremembered Empire, almost everybody loves this scene. They do not agree with us that Gulliman was not in any danger, should not have been in any danger. We mentioned in our last discussion that Gulliman should have been able to take him out without breaking a sweat. Many people disagree with this. One of the things that that has been pointed out is that Gulliman was not armed and wasn't wearing his battle armor. Now, this in itself is problematic. Okay, this is where I don't agree. Gulliman was clearly... I reread it, right? In preparation.
Yeah.
Gulliman was wearing armor. They don't mention specifically, I don't think, that it was ceremonial armor. He wasn't wearing his gauntlets because he took them off to shake hands. And he wasn't wearing a helmet. But he was wearing armor. And I don't see why it wouldn't be his battle plate. I don't see why he would have toy armor. It's not like Gulliman would have trouble like carrying the weight of his power armor. Space Marines are not armored knights. They are... I think they're better understood as cyborgs because they practically live in their armor.
Yeah.
They connect to it directly. They connect it through like sort of connectors on their skin that connects into the armor. So
it's a black armor base.
Moves. Yeah, exactly. And the armor moves. They're cyborgs. They don't have no problem wearing their armor. So I don't see why he would be wearing ceremonial plate. Okay, so one thing is, was he in real danger? We argued that he wasn't. Most people argue that he was. What are your thoughts on this?
There's no way he was in danger, knowing what we know about Primarchs. Like, no matter how they wrote that scene, no matter how desperate it seemed, he was not in danger. Like, it was just... It was awful. I hated it. It was just one of the worst parts of the book.
It was, what was it, like 5, 10? It was 10 headhunters?
Yeah.
Okay, they managed to get his inner sanctum. They were armed. He was not. They were fully armored. He was not.
Yeah.
You don't think they could have taken him out?
Oh, hell no.
They had no chance. Well, then why did they try?
Because they were the only ones that made it. I don't know. They figured they could do it.
Because, that's the bone of contention. I would agree with you that... But perhaps take a more nuanced look. I think they had a chance. I mean, if bullets hadn't slowed, they might have gotten one on him.
Yeah.
But they did the whole bullet time thing.
These guys are taking hits from all kinds of things, from Titans and whatnot. Bolter shells shouldn't bother them.
Yeah, didn't Lorgar take a hit from an Inferno gun or something?
A plasma annihilator cannon from Warhound Titan.
Yeah, and he survived. So yeah, it's hard to believe. But I guess if you do get a mass reactive bolt gun round to the face, even a Primarch would have trouble shrugging that off.
Probably, but they all have bullet time, so it doesn't matter.
Okay, here's where I want to nuance our position. We said straight up that this was stupid, and it was a garbage scene, and it should have been there. I'd like to stake a more nuanced position by stating that it was having reread it, it's a well-paced action scene. It is fun. It is a cool scene when you think about it. It's just that I don't think we could shake the fact that it's hard to believe the danger for us. Gulliman should have been able to like take him out barehanded without breaking a sweat.
Yeah.
That I think that's our position, right? Cuz we did I think we may have been a little shitty on it. Like, I think we might have, I don't think we took the scene very seriously, and I think that we may have been a little more strident than perhaps the scene deserved, because it's a well-written scene. I don't think we should have, like, straight up, like, laughed at it. It's just that I don't believe the danger. As I read it, I did not feel that the danger was believable.
Not at all.
Unless one of those Alpha Legionaries was Alpharius, which is possible. We don't know.
And well, they're all dead, right? So it probably wasn't.
Yeah, but you don't know how Alpharius operates. Maybe he would teleport out at the last second and teleport one of his own guys in right before he dies.
Yeah, I highly doubt
that. If one of them was Alpharius or Omegon, yeah, maybe that would work. But yeah. I think it's mentioned everywhere in the books that it's going to need a Primarch to take out a Primarch.
Yeah.
Primarchs don't go down easy. In all cases, I believe it's a Primarch that takes it. Like, all the ones that we know die, it's Primarch.
Yeah, even things that are like greater demons or avatars, like, lose to these guys.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, exactly. Lorgar killed an avatar, I think, twice. No, not Lorgar, sorry. Fulgrim. Fulgrim kills an avatar.
So does Lorgar. He does an Illyrian.
Okay, yeah. Okay, that's what I'm thinking of. So they take out avatars, but... And not only avatars. I mean, like, Fulgrim took out avatar. He took out an avatar. He took out a bunch of other stuff, too.
Yeah, he destroyed a wraith lord with his bare hands.
And that's where we were coming at in the first episode when we discussed power levels, like Primarch power levels.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not... It is inconsistent, but I don't think it needs to be consistent. And once again, it takes a Primarch to kill a Primarch. I mean, Sanguinius dies at the hands of Horus. Guliman gets mortally wounded at the hands of Fulgrim. Alpharius supposedly dies at the hands of Guliman. Can you name one that wasn't killed by another Primarch? With Vulcan, it's Conrad Kurz.
Maybe... Well, the lion wasn't killed. He was mortally wounded by Luther.
Okay. That's an exception. That's the exception that proves the rule. It took a Luther to do the same job.
Yeah, Luther kicks ass anyway, but...
Okay, that's. I think that's how I'll defend myself. I think that our listeners were correct, that we may have been a little aggressive and a little strident against this scene, and that we shouldn't have laughed at it. I still think that when you got to shoot, you shoot, you don't talk. That action movie trope kind of bugs me, but the scene, it was a fun scene. It was well-paced. The whole bullet time thing didn't really bother me because it's kind of cool to see how maybe a Primarch sees the battle. Like, sees the battle against him and shit. He just, like, he can break it down to that level. That's how fast they are. The scene itself is good. I didn't believe the danger. And that's I think, where I disagree with, again, like, 95% of our listeners that seem to like it.
Yeah, I just kept going through it, just reading, like, well, when is he going to kill them? You know, how long is this going to take? How many pages?
Yeah. Well, we know it may be unfair because we know he's not going to die. We know for a fact he's not going to die. That also takes away some of the danger. It's just I found that the threat against him wasn't much of a threat for a Primarch.
No.
Like, even naked in his bathrobe, he should be able to take out 10 legionaries.
Yeah, for sure.
In a space bathrobe.
Just why do you,
just throw an abacus at him. Just throw an abacus at him, it'll be done.
Exactly.
Okay. Anyways, I agree. Actually, this in this particular point, I do agree with our listeners that we did not respect this scene enough. Doesn't mean we like it, but I think we were wrong to be so strident.
Sure.
So, that's a point for our listeners, I think.
Damn.
I think... Well, you know, we're not going to win all of these.
That's true.
We'll count up the points at the end and see if we beat our listeners. That's just retarded. Okay. I think we're all in this together. One of the things I'm loving about doing this podcast, and one of the things that makes me take the time, the endless hours of editing to actually put out a show and do all this, is because it's such a great forum for discussing these things that we love and I love talking about. And whenever we're wrong about something, let us know, because we love talking about this. It's definitely, we're never going to take offense. So let's move on from the Headhunters to, I guess, a cynical slant that we had. This is another thing that's come up in discussions about our review of Unremembered Empire, is the idea that I guess we disliked the book because it wasn't the book that we wanted it to be, and that's kind of unfair to the book that it is. Shall I explain?
Go for it.
You and I both looked at it. I wanted to read Unremembered Empire so bad I skipped Vulcan Lives, which turned out to be a big mistake. I was hoping this was gonna follow from the observation that the lion makes at the end of Prince of Crows or Savage Weapons. Which one is it? Is it the end of Savage Weapons?
What does he say exactly?
When he says that Horus isn't my only brother that has an eye on the throne.
Oh, that's Savage Web. I'm pretty sure. Fuck, I can't remember, actually.
It's one of the two.
Yeah.
It's another example that the listener that knows is going to be screaming at his iPod. It's like, fuck, it's Savage Weapons, you idiots. Because I do that sometimes. Well, not idiots there, but... but at the end of one of those books, yeah, there's this comment about the lion essentially calling out Gulliman's ambition and saying it's like, yeah, he's just like Horace. And Gulliman, and I think I remember, and that's what I hoped it was going to be. I was hoping that it was going to be the book that makes the Ultramarines really interesting by making Gulliman into something less than perfect than the perfect son, in that like maybe he does have flaws, maybe his ambition is a flaw, maybe he is just like Horace, but he doesn't turn against the Imperium in the same way. But maybe creating Imperium Secundus is almost like creating, like turning away from the Imperium, and in a way it kind of is. He essentially gives up on the throne, and Sanguinius clearly doesn't, and the Lion clearly don't, because they leave.
Yeah,
but he kind of does give up on Terra, and I wanted to build on that and make Gulliman a little less of the perfect character. But they spend all of Unremembered Empire just saying how, no, he's not Horus. He's not like Horus. He doesn't have ambition like Horus. He loves his father. He loves the Imperium. And he's doing everything he's doing is justified in Unremembered Empire. Instead of making it a little more interesting that maybe some of the shit that he's doing isn't justified, maybe he isn't the perfect son. And that would make him, for me, more interesting. And that's what I was hoping Unremembered Empire was going to be. And now the criticism we've received about that is that we're basing our appreciation of the book based on the book that it isn't rather than the book that it is.
Okay.
What do you think? Is that fair?
Well, I don't know. Isn't that all up to your, like, the reader?
Of course it's up to the reader of whether or not they appreciate the book. But I think what that basic argument is that we're being unfair to it. We're being unfair to it because instead of commenting on what it is, we're commenting on what we would want it to be. And that is, of course, a fair statement to make. I think I don't think anybody would suggest that it's not a fair statement to say this isn't the book that I wanted. But then to proceed to say that it wasn't good based on that metric is perhaps unfair.
Okay, I getcha.
So what do you think? Do you think our appreciation of the book is unfair? Did we take a cynical slant to it?
Ooh.
It's a hard one to answer, I know.
I don't know, because I mean, I just, I, even if it was what I wanted it to be, I don't think I would have liked the book anyway.
How do you figure? Because we both agree that what we wanted to see was a little more nuance for the Ultramarines.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just maybe it was just the way it was done. Like, I don't like the book, and I don't think that anything's going to change my opinion on it or how I view it.
Okay, You didn't like the writing style. What in it particularly that you didn't like? If you remove, say that we get the book that we want, that you and I wanted, a book where a Gulliman is being taken to task, it's not just a long apology for Gulliman's actions, and clearly he does have ambition. Clearly he wants to have his own Imperium. It's fortuitous that Horus gave him the opportunity to essentially declare independence from the Imperium. This is not the Gulliman we get in Unremembered Empire. We get one that is crippled by self-doubt. He doesn't want to do anything bad. Everything he does is essentially justified in Unremembered Empire. And in many ways, it's apologism for Gulliman's actions. This is our view of it. This is how we view it. But say that we got the book that we wanted. What would you still not like about it? Because you said you liked the Conrad Kurz part. And let's forget about the headhunters, because that's just it's a
chapter. Let's forget about the headhunters.
No, it's a chapter. It's a chapter in the book. So let's remove that. And what do you not like about the book?
Give me a sec here to think about that.
You want to ponder? You got to ponder?
I'm pondering.
Okay. You see, on the Age of Darkness podcast, we ask difficult questions.
Damn difficult questions. I don't know. Maybe I'm not a big of a fan of Ben Abnett as other people are. Like.
Okay. But you loved Legion and you loved No Fear.
Actually, I didn't particularly like Legion very much.
Oh, yeah, because of John Grammaticus. You hate John Grammaticus. Could it be that's the reason you don't like the book?
Possibly, but I don't know. I just, most of his stuff I just don't seem to like, maybe because it's focused around the Ultramarines.
Maybe. I guess, you know, not liking a Legion isn't going to make you like the book that's about that Legion. It's like the same reason you don't like Scars. I think you're unfair with your dislike of Scars, but you don't like White Scars, so how do you expect to like that book?
Exactly right.
Okay. By the way, I'm not trying to put you on the spot here. I'm just trying to to be fair to all the comments that we've gotten. And this is another one where I think it's fair. I think it's a fair comment that we didn't, that I guess we unfairly maligned Unremembered Empire because it wasn't what we wanted. And that's an unfair kind of thing to say. Because a lot of the books, a lot of the elements of this story I like. And now that I've reread Vulcan Lives and in the proper order, actually, I love the Grammaticus and Narek stuff. I thought Narek was worthless in the first time I read it because I hadn't read Vulcan Lives before.
Yeah, well, wouldn't that comment be more fair if we were actually doing just a straight-up book review of it?
What do you mean?
Like giving our rating on the book. Okay. And, so what have a lot of other people do?
So since we're actually just discussing it instead of doing like a review, like we're not, at the end of the day, we're not giving it stars and we're not saying it's like buy immediately or, you don't need to buy this one.
Yeah, we give it 8 power fists out of 10 power fists or something.
That's
like
a lot of power fists. That's a lot of power fisting. 10. Maybe, but I think it's fair that we've been taken to task for this. I think that's another element that I'm gonna have to give point to our listeners. I think that wasn't fair. And once again, it's not gonna make us like the book, the fact that it wasn't what we wanted. But to malign it for that I don't think that's fair. Because
okay, I get you.
So I guess if I had gotten the book that I wanted, I guess like if Gulliman is presented as sort of a like Horus's opposite number, they're both sort of creating their own Imperium, but Horus, wants to kill his father to do it, where Gulliman is happy just seceding his area and then trying to rally brothers to their cause. Gulliman still winds up being on the side of the Imperium. I mean, we want Gulliman to turn to chaos and go fight. Go try to take Terra. I think like what we wanted was a little more nuance in that character, give him a little bit more ambition and just make him a more interesting character. Say we got that book, and then you keep all the other elements with Grammaticus, Narek, Conrad Kurz, with the Pharaoh structure and all, like illuminating McCrag and the cool space wolves and the dark angels, and give that would allow to the lion to have his cynicism to be sort of reinforced, making him a more interesting character. You have all those same elements and you change Gulliman's personality. I think I like this book. So that's why I'm going to give this point to going to give up another point to our listeners. I think they made a and once again, we've received this comment a few times, and I think that's a fair one. I think it's fair to say that we shouldn't malign this book for not being the book we wanted.
Do you think maybe we had that sort of mindset going into it after reading the short stories about the Ultramarines? I can't remember what it's called.
You mean Rules of Engagement?
Yeah, where it seems like they're just going around attacking everybody, even loyalists.
Well, they're practicing to maybe fight the Salamanders in Rules of Engagement.
Well, that's it, right? Like maybe that sort of skewed our view. Like, oh, cool! Like, look what he's actually doing.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah, you add that to the comments that the lion makes, and you add a lot of these elements together, and you wind up with, I think, what we thought was a cooler story. But the story as it is, I don't think is bad. So yeah, I think that's good comment. We probably shouldn't have maligned it for those reasons. I still would have liked it to be that way, though.
Yeah.
But okay, let's forget about that. That wasn't a very fair statement. Oh, I guess we already covered the next one. We actually... we covered two at the same time.
Perfect.
So not only were we were cynical, but the other was that we wanted more nuance from Gulliman. So we just did points 3 and 4. Damn it. That means our listeners get an extra point.
Well, I don't know. I still want more nuance from Gulliman regardless.
Oh, yeah, of course. We both do. It's just that in of itself doesn't make the book bad.
Yeah.
And I think we might have been wrong about that. But remember, that was our first episode. We did not know what the fuck we were doing. We don't know now, but we're less strident about it. We're sure, less confident in our opinions. Okay, this is, I guess, the last big element of criticism that we've received is that we think the Pharaoh structure is stupid. What we said last time was that we like the Pharaoh structure and Sothos. We like the idea of it being sort of a beacon. We like the beacon illuminated McCrag. I think that's really cool. And the fact that you wind up creating a lighthouse in a storm, and that all the ships that are stranded in rough waters of the warp sort of wind up finding their way through the warp storms and find their way to McCrag. We never said that was not cool. What we said was that the idea of it being like of it also teleporting, we didn't understand what that added. and it seemed like a cop out trying to figure out how to get the lion and Gulliman out of the trap, because I guess we didn't get why it teleported. And I guess the point was that we may have made too much of what was a minor plot point. And I think that was this is another thing that a few people have mentioned about how I guess the Pharaoh structure maybe wasn't stupid, and it was a pretty minor point that we may have made too much of. What do you think?
I don't know. I still think it's stupid, but
I think I still don't like the fact that it teleports. However, I was thinking about this: the fact that it teleports, maybe that helps explain why Vulcan reappears there. Or it doesn't reappear there. He reappears at McCrag.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I still think it's stupid. The fact that it teleports. I really like the idea of the Pharaoh structure. I really like the fact that I love the whole Illuminati McCrag. I think it's awesome. It just, I find that the teleporting part didn't add anything to it. It didn't add anything to the story. That's I think that's what we were getting at. It just, I didn't think that it transported. But here's the thing. That was a minor point. That was a very minor point in the story. So maybe making too much of it wasn't fair. What do you think?
Yeah, I still don't like it, though.
Yeah, I still don't like it either.
I'm not going to change my mind.
I still think that the fact... Because it doesn't add much. Why can there be another way? Because the only use it has in the story is getting the lion and Gulliman out of the battle with Kurz. But there's a million other ways to do it.
Yeah.
It took me out of the story. So I don't... But everything else I like about the Pharaoh structure, I think it's a wicked plot point. And I love the idea of illuminating McCrag. That's one of those lines that stick with me in the whole Horus Heresy series. If I had to come down with 10 lines that I like in the whole Horus Heresy series, Illuminate McCrag would be in my top 5. I love it. So, I don't know. I think, yeah, maybe we made too much of it, but I'm not changing my mind about that one. I think it's silly. So, okay, now that we've addressed some of the more specific criticisms that we've garnered, I think perhaps we can discuss a little bit about whether or not we have a reappraisal of the book. What do you think of it now? Has your opinion changed, especially after rereading Vulcan Lives?
Honestly, not really, to be honest. I still don't like the book.
But do you think it's a bad book? I don't think anybody's asking you to like it, but we said it was bad. And I think that's the stronger question. Is it a bad book, or is it just that we don't like it?
More the fact I don't like it. I wouldn't say it's a bad book, but it's probably my least favorite from all the books that are out there in the Heresy.
And this in a series that includes Furious Abyss, or Battle for the Abyss.
Yeah.
You like it less than Battle for the Abyss?
At least I can laugh a lot and have a little bit of fun with Battle for the Abyss.
It is. It can be fun at times. I'm looking forward to rereading that one, actually. And I'd like to reread it and try to stay positive throughout the whole thing. I think that's, in my own opinion, I like it better now that I've had time to reflect on it, and that after I've read Vulcan Lives in the proper order. I had already read Vulcan Lives when we did our last review, but I hadn't read it right before. And there's just some things that I forgot about. Last, like 2 weeks ago when we were talking about Vulcan Lives, I said that, like, the B story, when I first read it, seemed worthless because I read it out of order. So this whole thing setting up the Fulgurite spear and Narek and all that stuff, it's like I didn't care. I knew what was going to happen to Narek. I didn't care. But now reading them both back to back, I kind of appreciate that element of the story a lot more. And I can't get enough of Kurz. And honestly, I think we may have been a little cynical about it. I think that being our first episode, I think we were looking for strong opinions. I don't think it's one. I don't think it's the worst book. I don't even think it's in the top 5 worst books. But it's definitely in the lower, like in the lower tier.
Yeah, I don't think it's the worst book. It's just one of.
You just said it was the worst book.
I said it was my least favorite book.
Okay. I don't think it's a bad book at all. I really don't think it's a bad book at all. And once again, I hope that in our earlier review, we didn't come out as saying that much that it was just a terrible piece of shit. I don't think we ever believed that. But I like it better now. I honestly, the more I think about it, the less I'm bothered by some of the things that bothered me before. And especially after rereading Vulcan Lives. Especially after receiving so much feedback from our listeners about this. And once again, we sort of concentrated our discussion on one of the comments that we've received, one of the myriad comments that we received that seemed to synthesize everything really well. But I appreciate, I'm actually grateful for all the comments that we've received over the last couple months about this episode. And it has forced me to reevaluate it a little bit. And so please keep the comments coming, and we will keep trying to address them on air.
For sure, yeah.
As much as possible. And this is not the last time, I think, that we're going to be discussing Unremembered Empire. So long as more comments come in and more viewpoints come in, we will keep coming back to them. If anything, I want this show to be like a running discussion of these things that we love, like a continuous running discussion. And if we can be a focal point to contribute to a discussion, I think that's a great sort of goal for us.
Yeah, for sure.
Any final comments about Unremembered Empire Redux?
Nope.
You're just happy to be done talking about it, aren't you?
Yep.
I'll just leave saying that I don't think this is a bad book at all. It's good. It's just, as I said myriad times, it wasn't what I wanted it to be. That's not a reason not to like it. So I think we can close it out now for Unremembered Empire, part two. We will, once again, keep the comments coming. We want to hear what you have to say. And a lot of people may not have even listened to our first episode because, you know, first episode, not a lot of people are going to go back to the first when they start listening to us. They'll just start somewhere somewhere else. So if you haven't sent us a comment about Unremembered Empire, please do. And let's keep this discussion going, guys and girls. We love you all. So let's move on from book club. What are we going to do next time?
What should we do? Because it's who did the last pick?
I did the last pick. I did two in a row. I did two in a row, right? Because I wanted because I chose to do Vulcan Lives, and then I sort of planned out to do Unremembered Empire after. So I kind of like picked up two spots. So I'm guessing it's only fair that you get two picks. Ooh. So the next two episodes you get to pick. So for this next episode, for episode 14, what do we do?
We're going to do a Dark Angels extravaganza.
Oh, are you planning things ahead? Are we going to do another two books in sequence?
Yes, sir.
Holy hell. Now we're abandoning our entire goal of doing things completely out of sequence, just picking something we like to do.
Yep.
So, okay, why don't you introduce the books that we're going to do in the next two episodes?
We're going to do Descent of Angels and Fallen Angels.
And you're not afraid of burning out with Dark Angels?
Nope, not at all.
Okay, that's fair.
I need something to lift my spirits, you know, a little bit right now.
No Grammaticus in those ones.
Yeah,
no John Grammaticus. That's good. I think Descent of Angels is another one of those incredibly controversial books. That's another one that wasn't what a lot of people wanted it to be. And I think we can have a lot of discussion about that one. That is
for
fair.
Sure.
So in 2 weeks, sir, we will be doing Descent of Angels, and then 2 weeks after that, Fallen Angels. And then in the year 2030, we're going to be doing the third part of the trilogy.
Yeah, hopefully by then.
All right, so let's move on to the last bit. All right, welcome back to the End Times. What time is it, Mark?
Time for the two-week hobby challenge.
It is time for the two-week hobby challenge. First off, what was your two-week hobby challenge?
After I restripped my Melkador, to get the reds built up on it, and that's what I planned on doing.
Okay. I planned on griming up two Lehman Russes to get them over nice and over with. I originally wanted to wait to get some Winter Shrieking Grime from AK, but I can't find it around here for some reason. And I'm not going to import it from Spain because it costs a fortune. It's like the shipping fees are just... they're just onerous for such a small product. So instead, I planned on trying something different and trying to finish up those two Lehman Russes for my Auxilia, for my Imperialist Militia, sorry.
Okay. Awesome.
And for our listeners, two-week hobby challenges, Graham was planning on finishing up some Space Wolves, heavily converted Space Wolves based on Chaos Warriors. Picks will be on the Facebook page this week, but they are awesome. So he planned to get a bunch more done. And then Philip, as usual, the ever stalwart Philip, wanted to do a Rhino and a Death Guard. I think he was doing a Praetor, right?
Yeah, Praetor.
And he claimed that that's a small challenge. That's a lot of work. So, Mark, did you succeed in your two-week hobby challenge?
I sure did. I got that thing stripped, I got it reprimed, and I got the reds built up on it. Very nice this time. Actually, I did proper mixing.
Nice.
So it looks really good. And I actually managed to use... the Death Shroud Clear from Forge World.
Oh, we're gonna have to get you to review the Forge World paints maybe next time. That's a good idea. I gotta write that down.
Yeah, it worked really well. Basically, instead of having to wash it by hand, so there'd be a lot of streaking, I used this, and there was I think there's one little spot where it's streaked, but that's going to be easy enough to fix. So it looks really good.
Nice. All right. As for my own challenge, I actually did finish up my Lehman Russes. Once again, I didn't use the products I wanted to use. So what I wound up doing is using a bunch of oil paints I have lying around. What I did was this like dot technique for weathering vehicles. And what you do is you take a bunch of different colors of oils, of oil colors, you know, 3-4 different color oil colors that, you know, is appropriate for the color of the vehicle. So if you're painting a vehicle green and you want to sort of work on like weather the paint tones, use like, you know, yellows and different kinds of greens and stuff like that. And then you do dots, like random dots all over the vehicle. Like just little dots of paint everywhere, and try to mix it up too, so it's not all the same color. Then wait about 25 minutes, half an hour, till the paint cures, and then take mineral spirits. So you take like white spirit or something like that, and then you sort of like streak down and up to actually like streak out all the paint. Some of the dots will disappear. Most of it will create streaks. And since the colors should be similar to your original color, you get like a lot of tonal variation. It's a really cool technique. Maybe we'll do a segment where I can discuss it in more length. That's sort of the basics of this technique. So I took some burnt umber, raw umber, and black paints, and I did the dots over the winter the streaked winter camouflage that I did. Not the streaked winter camouflage. Remember the winter whitewash I had done last time?
Yeah.
Like the chipped wash. And then I did this, and then, you know, I did pretty heavy streaking with the heavy washing with the mineral spirits. And it turned out great, actually.
That's actually really cool. I've never heard of anything similar to that, to be honest.
No, like, I'll have to give you some more info, but it's amazing technique for getting tonal variations on vehicles. I wouldn't do this on a regular figure, though.
Yeah, like the only thing I've heard that even sounds similar to that is using a product from Humbrol, their decal fix, or their decal fix.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, basically you can apply the paint and with the weathering pigment with the decal fix. And you can basically mess it up. You can let it dry. You can go back at it. Like, it sounds similar, but what you're doing is really cool.
Yeah, maybe we'll do a segment about it. Actually, I'd like to do some more things about like more complex hobby techniques. It's just a podcast is such an audio medium. It's not easy to do it. I'm better off just linking to a blog post about it or something like that, or, you know, just tell people to read Steel Masters.
I know people probably still like to hear about it. It's
yeah, maybe
cool.
We'll do a segment. That'd be cool. But yeah, that's what I did, and they look great. Actually, I really like this technique. I got to use it more often. It's such a breath of fresh air to be doing some guard vehicles where I can use like camouflage and like heavy chippings and like a lot of damage. You don't really do that when you do Space Marine vehicles. Like maybe a bit of rusting, but they still have like these basic bright colors.
Mm-hmm.
And I like taking a break and doing some techniques from like the military modelers and everything like that. So it's kind of a breath of fresh air to be doing these Lehman Russes, but they're done now. So I got to move away from the Imperialist Militia and start doing some Iron Warriors again.
Wicked.
As for listener challenges, Mark, what do we have?
Philip's going to be joining us again. Way to go, Philip. He said he has to do some work on some bolt action Germans and also do what?
I said boo. That's not 30K related. I said,
no, the next one is, okay. He's got his death ground, Death Shroud Terminators primed, and he wants to get some more color on them other than green.
Awesome. Awesome. Can't wait to see him. Good stuff as usual. And Mark, what about you? What's your hobby challenge?
Do some more work on the Malkador.
How much more work?
Probably start to get some of the other colors done, like the bolt guns. Start doing up some of the little details on it. So basically a little bit of detail work, I guess.
Okay. That's good. And my two-week hobby challenge is I'm actually not doing any models at all. I am going to be building up a second board for my trench warfare table.
Oh, no way. You're actually going to do that?
So a little while ago, I started working on a Sol Immortalis trench warfare themed table with just some stuff I had lying around. So some chipboard boards and some blue insulating foam that I found at a construction site. And I just started working on it. And it's been a little while now that I haven't done any work on it. So first board is pretty much done, and I want to build the second board to bring it up to 4x4 so it's usable in Zone Metallus. I'd like to get that done soon. So that my 2-week hobby challenge is going to be this: build the second board. So hopefully I can start, you know, doing detailing soon.
For sure, yeah. How much is that going to cost me?
We will we'll decide on a price.
I've got prices from someone else on boards they make, so I have an idea of what I'd offer you.
How did you know that was my plan?
Ha 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 ha. I think you told me it was your plan, actually.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, yeah, it's because I figured if I do a good enough job, just sell it to you so it gets some use. It's not going to get any use to my apartment. I'm just doing this project mainly for fun.
You can't convince Debbie to play with you?
Yeah, I think she's got better things to do.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm gonna work on that board and hopefully have some updates. And maybe I can throw up some pictures on the Facebook too, so people see what I'm doing. It's a really fun project. Awesome. It's a really, really fun project. So that's what I'm gonna be for the next 2 weeks. But after that, it's gonna be models. After that, it's gonna be Iron Warriors. So
yeah,
for these 2 weeks, it's gonna be terrain. Then I'm doing Iron Warriors.
You should have your decals by then.
Yeah, hopefully, and then I can finally get that done. So those are the 2 week hobby challenges.
So, JP, what are you going to play us out to this time?
Honestly, I had trouble finding a good song to go with Unremembered Empire because there's just so much going on in this book. So I figure instead of being thematic with the subject matter, I'll be thematic with the last time we talked about Unremembered Empire. And we finished that finished that episode with World Eater, I believe. So we finished it with some Bolt Thrower, which makes me realize we haven't played Bolt Thrower in 12 episodes. That's a long time to not play Bolt Thrower. Well, except for the Bolt Thrower at the beginning of every episode. But we're going to play some more Bolt Thrower. And we're going to continue on from where we left off. We had finished with World Eater, and now we're going to go right into Cenotaph, which is the next part in the never-ending song. Next episode will be part three of the Conquest System.
We're going to come up with something neat for you guys.
Yep, we got some ideas. And we're also going to be doing... starting our discussion on Dark Angels. So that was episode 13. As usual, I'm JP.
And this is Mark.
Thanks for listening.
Glory to the first.